Let's call to order the Board of Directors special meeting for November 19. The only opening comments I have is, sorry we're starting 25 minutes late, but that executive committee meeting was just so exciting that we decided to drag it out for another 20. The first item on the agenda will be roll call.
On the roll for the Board of Directors special meeting of November 19, 2019, Director Abe-Koga. Director Barrett?
Here.
Director Bouders? Director Canepa?
Here.
Director Chavez? Here. Director Cutter is not present. Director Joya?
Here.
Director Groom?
Present.
Director Haggerty? Director Ju? Director Kim? Director Nis? Director Mandelman?
Here.
Director Miley? Director Mitchoff? Here. Director Ronan? Director Ross? Director Sanchez? Director Sparing? Director Wagon Connect? Here. Director Zane?
Here.
Secretary Sinks.
Here.
Vice Chair Rice.
Here.
Chair Hudson.
Here.
We have a quorum.
Okay, please join me in the Pledge of Allegiance.
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the Republic for which it stands, one nation under God,
okay, public comment is open. Now's the time for anyone in the audience to address us on an item not on the agenda. Do we have any cards? Seeing none, last call, public comment. Don't rush all up at once. Public comment is closed. First item, on consent calendar, items 3 through 11. Anybody wish to pull an item? Any cards to pull an item? Do I hear a motion?
So
moved. Motion Joya, second Canepa. All those in favor say aye. Opposed? Seeing none, we're on to, oh, my goodness, there's on to me. The executive committee met on Monday this morning, November 19th, and approved the minutes of July 23rd. The committee received the presentation hearing board quarterly report July to September of this year. The committee then received an update on recent activities of the Bay Area Regional Collaborative. The committee then reviewed and discussed the staff presentation, update of production system office, and authorization to execute contract amendments for production system office. The committee recommends the board authorize the executive officer to execute contract amendments with the 7 recommended vendors listed in Table 1 of Agenda Item 6, totaling $1,859,439. The committee then reviewed and discussed the staff presentation update on Air District implementation of Assembly Bill 617. Finally, the committee then reviewed and discussed the staff presentation committee chair report on Board of Director meeting agendas. The committee recommends the board provide direction to staff, place committee report on Board of Directors meeting agendas under the consent calendar. The next meeting of the executive committee will be at the call of the chair. I move that the board approve the executive committee's recommendations. This includes the chair report of the executive committee. Second, Sparing. You had a comment too? Seeing none, all those in favor say aye. Opposed? Seeing none, we will move on to, my goodness, we're moving quick. Item 13, the update on Canadian oil sands crude. Mr. Broadbent.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, members of the board. This is the main item for you today for your board meeting. And I just wanted a little bit of a context here this morning before I hand it over to Damian. I know all of you are aware of the fact that for some time now, many, many months, the public has been raising concerns about the fact that the refineries might be increasing their use of oil sands that are from Canada as part of their crude being processed here. So you all know we have 5 refineries. They provide the gasoline for and jet fuel and other products here for the West. And there's been a genuine concern expressed to this board that indeed the Canadian oil sands will increasingly make up the crude that is going to be processed by these refineries. And so in order for us to understand this situation and this issue better, as you all recall, the board took a trip back in August. 6 board members, along with staff, were able to visit. And today represents somewhat of a report out from that trip, but also I thought it made sense for us to really take a step back and really provide for you kind of the lay of the land with regard to understanding this situation. Let me hand it over to Damian to add my remarks, and then I know he can introduce Victor.
Thank you, Jack. So as Jack had mentioned, to better understand the concerns that were being brought forward, staff, board and members of the Advisory Council went to Alberta and British Columbia to view the extraction, refining and transport processes for oil sands crude firsthand and to meet with members of the Canadian, Alberta and other local government officials and regulators, the oil sands industry and First Nations and environmental groups. The purpose of this was to get their perspective on the environmental and climate impacts of this resource. Victor Douglas, the manager of our Rural Development Section, was among those who went to Canada and will present a summary of the facts and lessons learned regarding Canadian oil sands today. However, in addition to Mr. Douglas, and to give the board a flavour of the perspectives we benefited from in the preparation of this report, staff has invited four Canadian and local speakers to give brief presentations that we hope will complement our findings. Dave Collier is an industry consultant and will be speaking on behalf of Suncor, one of the largest Canadian extraction companies. Sephora Bergman is an adjunct professor at York University and International Campaigns Director for Stand Earth, an organization that designs and implements strategies that make protecting our planet everyone's business. Their current campaigns focus on shifting corporate behavior, breaking the human addiction to fossil fuels, and developing the leadership required to catalyze long-term change. We also have Charlene Alec with us today. Charlene is a First Nations council person from the Tsleil-Waututh Nation. This is a First Nation community in Burnaby, which is north of Vancouver, where the proposed Trans-Canada pipeline would terminate. Finally, we have Penny Opelplant, who is a local representative of Idle No More, an organization that calls on people to join in a peaceful revolution to honor Indigenous sovereignty and to protect the land and water. Thank you for your attention. I'll hand it over to Victor to go through our presentation and to our speakers.
Victor.
Good morning, Chair Hudson and members of the Board of Directors. In this presentation, I'll give you an update on our investigation into Canadian oil sands, also known as tar sands. Ready? Okay, thank you. In this presentation, I'll explain what oil sands are, where they can be found, and give an overview of the extraction techniques and the processes that are used to upgrade the extracted product. I'll provide a highlight of our August trip to Canada, including the site visits to an in-situ extraction operation, a visit to an oil sands oil ore processing facility, an aerial tour of surface mining operations, and our Edmonton and Vancouver meetings. And then I'll complete the presentation with a summary of our investigations, including Bay Area concerns and our conclusions to date. Oil sands are found in loose sandstone deposits comprised primarily of sand and clay and water saturated with bitumen. Bitumen is a very viscous form of petroleum that is too heavy or thick to flow or pumped without being diluted or heated. At 50 degrees Fahrenheit, it's as hard as a hockey puck. Alberta oil sands compositions can vary greatly, even within the same geologic formation. Deposits contain about 10% bitumen, but it can be up to as high as 20%, with 5% water and 85% sand and clay solids.
So if you'd like to see what that looks like at each of your positions, there's a little card. And it contains some of the tar sands. You can open it up, smell it, and touch it.
Reason.
I wouldn't do that.
Don't eat it, right?
The Canadian province of Alberta is approximately the size of Texas or France. There are three main regions from which oil sands come. The Athabasca region, which is shown in the light blue, which includes Fort McMurray, in the location of our site tours, the Collay region, which is south of the Athabasca region and is shown in dark blue, and then the Peace River region, which is west of the Athabasca region, shown in the median color of blue. Combined, all these areas, all these regions comprise an area approximately the size of New York State. Canadian oil sands represents 10% of the world's proven petroleum reserves. It's the third largest behind Saudi Arabia and Venezuela, and approximately 170 billion oils are produced each year from this region. There are two types of extraction processes. First is surface mining, and the other is in situ extraction. These extraction processes are mutually exclusive, and it depends on the depth of the deposits, and I'll get into more of that later in the presentation. In situ is used for deep deposits of oil sands, typically 200 meters or about 660 feet below the surface. This depth is necessary to ensure the prevention of a blowout, which is a major safety hazard. 80% of the oil sands in Alberta are accessible via in situ extraction. Surface mining is used to extract shallow deposits through vast open mining pits. This is used for the deposits less than 75 meters or 250 feet. It's cost prohibitive to go deeper than this because it creates too much waste material. 20% of the oil sands deposits are accessible to surface mining. Oh, and these depth criteria are the reasons why the two processes are mutually exclusive. In situ extraction represents 40% of Canadian crude production. There are two common methods: steam-assisted gravity drainage, shown above in the chart, and cyclic steam stimulation. But in general, steam is injected into the deposit. For both processes, steam is injected into the deposits to heat and liquefy the bitumen, and the resulting emulsion is pumped to the surface for further processing. This is an aerial view of an in-situ extraction and upgrading operation. In-situ, facilities consist of the following basic operational units: a series of well pads scattered throughout the oil sands deposits, a steam and power generation plant, which provides power for the facility and high-pressure steam for injection into the wellheads, a central processing plant where oil and water emulsion, where the oil and water emulsion produced at the injection well is separated, a water treatment plant where the recovered water is cleaned and recycled back into the process, and a production storage facility where the bitumen is diluted with natural gas condensates for storage and transportation via pipeline. An in-situ extraction process plant is generally much smaller and has a simpler footprint than an oil sand surface mining operation. Steam is essential to an in situ extraction process. Sorry about that. In situ oil sands facilities use water and natural gas for the generation of high pressure steam. This great demand for steam production is one of the primary reasons that oil sand production is so energy intensive. Once the bitumen emulsion is pumped to the surface, it is sent to a separation plant where the water, which is condensed steam, is removed from the bitumen. The processed water is cleaned, treated, and recycled back to the steam plant and has a 90% recovery rate. Clean bitumen is often diluted and sold to market, either to an upgrader or refineries, depending on the quality of the bitumen. The diluent is either naphthenic solvent, commonly referred to as naphtha, which is aromatic compounds such as benzene, toluene, ethylbenzene, or xylene, sometimes referred to as BTEX, or aliphatic hydrocarbon solvents from natural gas condensate, like pentene, or hexane. Diluted bitumen, or dilbit, is a heavy sour crude with high sulfur content and trace amounts of sodium, nickel, vanadium, and iron. Bitumen can also be upgraded to synthetic crude through fractionation and chemical treatment, removing most of its impurities. It's to produce a light, sweet crude with a low sulfur content and very almost non-detectable amounts of contaminants. Tailing ponds are used for water reclamation and the settling of fines. Tailing ponds pose a hazard to wildlife, primarily migrating birds. Facilities use scarecrows and air cannons to scare the wildlife away from these ponds. Now let's discuss surface mining. This is a diagram of an open pit mining extraction operation. Vegetation and topsoil are removed, and large trees are harvested and sold for lumber. The overburden, which is primarily sand and clay, is removed to allow access to the oil sands ore. This is an image of oil sands ores being extracted in a surface mining operation. These are images captured on our tours. On the left is an image of a oil sands processing and upgrading facility, and on the right, a surface mine with tailing ponds. Pictured on the left is a pickup truck next to one of the three stories tall mining trucks. These mining trucks hold 400 tons of oil sands ore. On the right shows a giant shovel with a 100-ton capacity next to the 400-ton mining truck. These images provide an illustration of the magnitude of the massive machinery used to extract oil sands from oil sands or from deposits. See the little circle in the picture on the right? That's Damian Breen, who happens to be my height. These are more images of oil sands extraction equipment. The engineer that I am is really wowed by the sheer size and scale of these incredibly large pieces of equipment. Oil sands ore is trucked to an ore preparation site and dumped into a hopper that feeds to a crusher that breaks the ore down to a proper size. The ore is mixed with water to create a slurry, which is about 8% bitumen, 40% water, and 50% solids. Oversized materials like petrified wood, rocks, and ice chunks are removed. Large diameter hydro transport pipes using heavy-duty slurry pumps conduct the slurry to the main extraction facility. This is an image of one of the hopper crushing units. This is an image of crushed ore being fed into a slurry preparation plant. This is where the slurry is fed to massive froth gravity separators. The oil sand slurry is pumped into large gravity separation units, typically referred to as primary separating cells or vessels. The bitumen attaches to bubbles and floats to the top of the vessel and is subsequently recovered and sent to a froth storage tank. The heavy silica sand sinks to the bottom of the vessel and is pumped to the tailing ponds for storage and water recovery. The bitumen froth product contains about 60% bitumen, 30% water, and 10% fine solids by weight. Similar to in situ operations, surface mine bitumen must be upgraded for transport to remote petroleum refinery operations, including a small fraction that may come to the Bay Area refineries. The bitumen froth is mixed with a solvent in order to reduce its viscosity. the diluted froth is processed through a series of gravity separation units for the final removal of the fines in water. This treatment produced a relatively clean bitumen product containing at least 98% bitumen with residual amounts of water and fine solids. Restoration is a major challenge for these operations. Only about 10% of the disturbed lands have been reclaimed to date. And all reclaimed land must be certified by the Alberta government. By law, 100% of disturbed lands will have to be reclaimed back to a trafficable landscape. This means the ability to sustain vegetation and vehicle traffic. This is mandated by the Alberta Energy Regulator. Oil sands mining operations are required to commit to the reduction of fine fluid tailings and reduce any current inventories. Operators must undertake research and development and submit annual progress reports. The reclamation process can take up to 15 years after the mine has been depleted, and a typical mine life in oil sands can be anywhere from 10 to 30 years. So from breaking ground to full restoration can take almost a half century.
Can I just ask a quick question since you're on this? How have all the sites been reclaimed?
No, only about 10% of the disturbed lands.
Okay, when did the Alberta government mandate the reclamation? What year was that passed?
It was redefined in 2011, but I'm not quite sure if that previous to that there was a mandate for reclamation. There's probably representatives here that could further elaborate on that.
Okay, thank you.
These images are provided to give you a sense of the scale of the surface mining and open pit operations. The left is a satellite image of the region around Fort McMurray, which is a city of 125,000 people, and is circled in red, with the surface mining operations above in the image. On the right is an aerial view of large tailing ponds taken during our aerial tour. These are more aerial surveillance images taken during the tour. This gives you an indication of how massive the footprint of surface mining operations are.
If you look very closely in those photographs, you can see little dots running along the road, and those are those four-story trucks. Three-story, sorry.
400 tons. During our tour, we also met with representatives of the organizations listed in the slide. And we have some of those representatives here today to give you their perspectives on oil sands extraction processes and piping. While there are major challenges, it is definitely not the Wild West in Alberta. Listed on the slides are the Alberta provincial and the Canadian federal government's environmental efforts. Environmental and community-led monitoring of air, water, snowpack, and wildlife for contaminants, establishing baselines for ecosystems, assessing change and impacts to traditional lifestyles and human health, working with local indigenous communities to expand monitoring efforts. Alberta province was the first to institute carbon emission pricing. It's capped GHG emissions at 100 megatons per year. It's committed to reduce province-wide methane emissions by 45% by 2025. Natural gas is primarily made of methane, which is a potent climate pollutant, and is the primary fuel used for steam generation in its situ extraction. Although there are environmental concerns in Canada, there are three main local concerns here in the Bay Area. The potential for increase in local toxic emissions, an increase in greenhouse gas emissions from mining oil sands compared to producing oil crude or other oil crudes, and potential water spills of heavier than water bitumen, and the subsequent impacts of marine and water quality in the bay and surrounding waters. I'm going to give you a recap of what we learned about oil sands crude. This is an chart of oil sands, the carbon intensity of oil sands and California crudes, and it shows that they are very similar in its intensity. The total carbon intensity is the total amount of GHGs produced per barrel of crude oil produced. This is from extraction to combustion, or well to wheel. This chart compares the API gravity, or a measure of the density, of various California and Canadian oil sands crude. The primary takeaway here is Canadian crudes are similar to California crudes in this respect, with Athabasca bitumen being the most dense of all those represented. This chart, which provides a comparison of the sulfur content and density of various crudes, showed the similarity between oil sands bitumen and California crudes, with California crudes at times having higher sulfur contents. I know this slide has a lot of information on it, but it shows the percentage of each Bay Area refinery's throughput that comes from Canada, including estimates of the crude that has the characteristics of oil sands crude. The main takeaway here is that while Bay Area refineries throughput can be up to 7% imported from Canada, only about 3 to 4% of those throughputs have the characteristics of oil sands crude.
I just ask a clarification on this chart since it's up before us. So the blue line, the blue bars are all imported Canadian crude, of which some of it is lighter and some of it's tar sand, so it's a bit of both. But the line, the brown line or the tan line, is specifically Canadian crude with properties similar to oil sands. So you're distinguishing them. So if I look at this, it's the refinery in the Bay Area that brings in the greatest amount of tar sand type is Valero. Based on, explain the brown line versus the blue bar.
Okay, the blue bars represents the amount of crude that's imported from Canada.
Right, but not all crude from Canada is tar sands.
That's correct.
Right.
And it refers to the numbers that are on the left of the charts.
Got it.
The orange bar refers to the amount of crude in the throughput that has the characteristics of oil sands crude, and those are measured by what's on the right side.
Okay, so those are percents.
Correct.
So the brown is the percent of the total crude that is of the total crude that comes from Canada that's oil sands type.
That has the characteristics
okay.
of
Got
oil
it.
Sands.
So you're a statistics guy, an engineer. Translate the percents to volume. So I wonder, which refinery brings in the greatest amount by volume? By volume of tar sand, of oil sands.
It would be Shell because of their total capacity at that facility is over 200 barrels versus Valero, which is in the 150, 140 range.
But
so
the,
Shell
but
is
the,
your.
But the oh, I see. Got it. All right. I was looking at the Phillips line. Okay. So the right. So the brown is the percent of the blue. And that so the volume in the last few years, Shell would be the first, followed by Valero.
Is correct.
That quite, but the brown is the percent
of the blue.
No, the percent of the total throughput at the refinery that happens to be from Canada have the characteristics.
Got it. Okay.
So, but what's
now
the,
I understand.
What's the story of Chevron? It looks like Valero is not buying anymore, and Chevron is. Is that what's
in
happening?
In 2017? Probably just don't have the data for 2017.
It looks like in 2017 that Chevron is buying Canadian crude, but they're not buying tar sands crude.
Right. The blue and
so
the brown are different.
Canadian crude is just traditional pipe in the ground, not this particular process.
So the brown means 0%.
Right.
of Chevron's has tar sands quality, so they don't bring in any.
And how do we interpret the Valero 2017 dot? Lack of a dot? Or, I'm sorry, lack of a bar?
Not all of the information is available at the same time. It depends on the reporting. So this is aggregated from a third-party source. So we can come back to you. We've been regularly updating the Ad Hoc Refinery Committee with these numbers and giving them presentations from the CEC. So it's probably that we just don't have that information right now.
And Marathon's the old Tesoro facility in Martinez.
And Mr. Chair, when I appreciate these are coming from a third party, but in a presentation, because I made the same assumption John did, and then once you explained it, I could see it's per volume. We need some additional information on this slide, because we're semi-lay people. Lay people are people who are looking at this out in the community that don't even if I don't understand it, they're not going to understand it. And so I think when we do this in the future, we need to put some explanatory information.
A more easily understood chart that may also show volume. Right.
Understood. Thank you.
Two more.
Ongoing Bay Area concerns about – there are ongoing Bay Area concerns about toxic emissions, climate pollutants, and oil spills. While the Air District does not have authority – or jurisdiction over oil spills and greenhouse gas emissions from the production of crude oil in Canada, we do, however, have jurisdiction over local toxic emissions. Any changes in emissions of toxic air contaminants as a result of changing crude slates will be reported and analyzed under Regulation 12, Rule 15, Refinery Emission Tracking. Potential health impacts in local communities on local communities from toxic emissions will be estimated through Regulation 8, Rule 18, Toxic Risk Reductions. If significant health impacts are found, the facility will be required to implement measures to reduce those impacts, including an installation of control technology. The Air District's AB 617 program will also examine the localized impacts of refinery emissions to nearby communities and will determine if further regulations are necessary. For major changes in crude oil processing, local refineries may need to install or modify physical equipment and or emission limits to accommodate those changes. These types of changes may trigger new source review and a requirement to analyze if there may be potential health impacts from toxics due to these changes. SAF is also developing Regulation 13.1, Significant Methane Releases. This rule would address methane emissions from refinery operations. In summary, oil sand extraction has significant local environmental impacts and with potential impacts here in the Bay Area. Oil sands crudes are similar in composition and impacts to California crudes. And approximately 4% of crude refined in the Bay Area comes from Canada and have the characteristics of oil sands crude. The Bay Area has a significant regulatory framework to address the potential impacts of oil sand crudes. We will need to continue monitoring the crude imports, and regulatory changes may be necessary if emissions increase. And finally, continued use of fossil fuels in California will continue to impact climate change. That concludes my presentation, and happy to address your questions.
Yes. Do we have other speakers that we want to keep going?
I'd suggest we go to the speakers, because some of our questions may be answered by speakers.
Yes.
So, Mr. Chairman, we've invited four speakers here that will complement the staff presentation, and I would suggest some of the board members may have questions that could be answered by the speakers too. Yeah. So
good, let's start them off. Damien.
So we'll first introduce Mr. Collier.
Good job.
He'll give you a perspective from the oil production industry.
Okay, you're good, Mr. Collier.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Good morning, everyone. My name is Dave Collier. I've spent nearly 40 years in the energy industry in Canada, including a fair bit of it in the oil sands. And more specifically and recently in the context of the oil sands, I co-chaired an oil sands advisory group with Sapura Berman, which had the mandate to provide advice to the Alberta government in terms of implementation of their Alberta Climate Leadership Plan. And I'm also chairing Emissions Reductions Alberta, which is an entity with a specific mandate to invest carbon revenue from that Alberta Climate Leadership Plan in technology and innovation to reduce emissions from the oil sands, but more broadly as well in Alberta. I want to first acknowledge the incredibly challenging circumstances that Californians are experiencing with the wildfires that are ongoing. We had a similar devastating experience in Alberta about 2 years ago with significant wildfires. I don't want to directly compare the two because I think that's unfair. But it was a very difficult time and a very difficult experience for a lot of people. And as difficult as the situation was at the time, I think the positive is it brought people together with a strong commitment to rebuild and move forward. And while the circumstances are different, I hope the same experience evolves in California. Suncor was very pleased to host, and Victor did a very good job, I think, of providing the overview, to host a group from the Bay Area Air Quality Management District for the tour back in August. And first, just on behalf of Suncor, want to express our appreciation for the interest that was shown in actually having a number of you come up and kick the tires, so to speak, and see it firsthand. And what I'd like to do on behalf of Suncor, and reflecting the commitment of many companies in the oil sands sector, just build on that visit with some brief remarks that focus on a few key areas. I could go into a lot of detail. I'll try not to. The first is just a perspective on climate change. Suncor believes that climate change is real, that it's a growing challenge, and that human activity is contributing to increased concentrations of GHGs in the atmosphere. Suncor also believes that we're in the early stages of a global energy transition, but that the pace and nature of that transition will be driven by a diversity of global factors, heavily influenced by consumer preferences in the end, that the energy demands of a growing global population will continue to increase, and that the pace of development and implementation of new technologies, while we're trying to accelerate that, is highly uncertain. This transition is going to take time, and while that transition takes place, we believe that hydrocarbons will remain a significant part of the global energy mix for many years to come. So the role of an energy producer like Suncor, in our view, is to seek and enable climate policy solutions, to invest heavily in technology and innovation to reduce greenhouse gas emissions, and to be a responsible partner with Indigenous peoples and with the communities where the company operates. If you ask the world where they'd like their oil to come from, and we do, they'd prefer it come from Canada. That being said, Canadian producers recognize that we are going to have to be competitive in global markets going forward, and that competition is going to be on the basis of our cost effectiveness, our GHG emissions intensity, and our social performance. And it all starts, I think, with leadership in climate policy. I would say that the province of Alberta is one of the world's most progressive and forward-thinking energy-producing jurisdictions. I think that's demonstrated by the fact that the province was the first jurisdiction in North America to put a price on industrial emissions, and in fact is the only one of the top 10 global energy or global oil producers that has a comprehensive carbon policy in place. Oh, the only one of the top 10. As Victor mentioned, it's also how Alberta became the first jurisdiction to legislate a sectoral cap on greenhouse gas emissions for the oil sands with the Alberta Climate Leadership Plan that was introduced in 2015. And in my view, if we're to maintain the momentum that's been established toward responsible climate policy and transition to a low-carbon future, then the leadership, the common ground that was exemplified by people coming together to support that climate leadership plan needs to be maintained, nurtured, and supported. A lot of different views on climate change. I think there is one common thread or unifying theme, and that is in the context of the discussion around climate change, and that is the technology and innovation will be a key lever to address this issue. That technology continues to have a significant impact on our GHG emissions intensity. Victor showed you some data. Oil sands performance continues to improve relative to that data that was shown. The average GHG emissions intensity, so emissions per barrel, of oil sands extraction has declined by 20% since 2009, and it could be at least another 20% lower by 2030. New mining projects, and Victor described what the mining recovery process is for oil sands, are using technology that results in an oil sands product at the same emissions intensity as the average barrel, the average barrel of crude refined in the U.S. So that's comparable to the average barrel across the U.S. Some of the oil sands in situ technologies that are being worked on have the potential to reduce emissions by as much as 75% from where they are today. So I firmly believe that going forward, the GHG emissions intensity of oil sands crude is going to compare very favorably with that of other crudes with which it's competing in the marketplace. And specific to the discussion today, I think it's also important to recognize that there's quite a broad spectrum of crude oil that's produced from the oil sands, ranging from very light synthetic to heavier diluted bitumen. And it's not accurate to state that all oil sands crude is in fact heavier than the crudes against which is competing in the market or is a higher GHG intensity. I want to talk a little bit about engagement and partnerships with Indigenous peoples. Innovation is not limited to the technologies that we apply to reduce environmental impact. Oil sands companies are innovating also when it comes to who we're working with and how we're working with them. The manner in which the industry interacts and works with Indigenous peoples has evolved. I think Suncor is a leading example of best practice in this area. And the trust and support of stakeholders and Indigenous communities is foundational, I believe, to successful energy development, whether that be utilizing traditional knowledge or whether it be forming economic partnerships with Aboriginal businesses. And just as an example of the latter, in 2017, Suncor and two First Nations, the Fort McKay and Mikisew Cree First Nations in Alberta, announced a partnership by which these two communities own a 49% interest in Suncor's New East Tank Farm development. This represents the largest single business investment by a First Nations business entity in Canada. So it's very significant. And more broadly, Suncor is on track to spend more than $650 million with Aboriginal businesses by the end of 2018. And to put that in context, that's close to 10 times more than the government of Canada spend on goods and services with Aboriginal businesses this year. And I don't pretend in any way to speak for Indigenous peoples in Canada, but I would observe in my experience that there is a broad diversity of views around oil sands development and around a related pipeline development. Many Indigenous communities do in fact support oil sands development, and I believe at last count there were 43 agreements in place between the Trans Mountain Pipeline and various Indigenous communities along that pipeline route. So fully acknowledge diversity of views, but just to make the point that there is fairly significant support out there from Indigenous communities. So just to sum up, Mr. Chair and Board, these are difficult and challenging issues. They're not easy to resolve. There's no easy answer. I think we need to collectively work to find the right balance of environmental, energy, and economic considerations. Those are the cornerstones. Leading change is not something one company, one government, one industry, or one stakeholder group can do alone. But I do hope that my remarks, along with the report that's been prepared by your staff, will demonstrate that the Canadian oil sands industry takes these issues very seriously, and it's working collaboratively to do its part on solutions. And I think together the actions that are being undertaken are demonstrating real progress on greenhouse gas emissions, and they're helping to build a pathway over time to the sort of inclusive low-carbon future that I think we all look forward to and envision over time. But that's not going to happen. That's not going to happen overnight. So I thank you very much,
thank
Chair
you.
And Board, for your your time today. I look forward to the rest of the question or the session, and happy to take any questions.
Just one question of him before he sits down. I have just one question. Appreciate your presentation. You commented about the Alberta provincial policy on climate change. I just had a question about that, because since we returned from our trip, a Canadian federal appeals court overturned the approval of the Trans Mountain pipeline on the basis that there needed to be more consultation with First Nations. And I understand it's not a final ruling, and the government is working to fix that, but that it did temporarily overturn the approval. But in response to that court case, court decision overturning the approval of the pipeline, the Premier of Alberta announced that Alberta was pulling out of the federal government, the Canadian federal government's climate change strategy. So doesn't that change the direction of Alberta? You commented about where Alberta is going, but my understanding is the Premier Notley said in response to this court decision overturning the Trans Mountain pipeline that they were pulling out of the federal government's climate strategies.
Yeah, so let me respond to that in two ways. First is just with respect to the challenge, the court challenge or the court review of the Trans Mountain decision and the specific issues that are left to be resolved. There are two. One is further review of marine impacts, and it's not that those issues were not looked at previously. They were looked at by government, but they were looked at outside the scope of the regulatory proceeding. The court basically said you need to put those into the regulatory proceeding. And the second is that the court concluded that the federal government had not sufficiently disposed its requirement or obligation to consult with First Nations, and that's further work that needs to be done. With respect to Premier Notley's response to all of that, I think fair to say there's some frustration with the senior level of government. But in the context of what we're talking about here, there's no change in Alberta's policy. The Alberta Climate Leadership Plan remains in effect. It has a cap on emissions. It has a carbon price, which is escalating over time. It has, as Victor said, a requirement to reduce emissions, methane emissions, by 45%. So there's no change in that regard. So in terms of the climate policy within which the oil sands industry is operating in Alberta, there's no change.
Mark, did you want to wait to the end or go now?
Just a quick question.
Okay.
Thank you. And thank you for your comments, your presentation. What is the break-even price, roughly, for a barrel of oil that comes from Alberta, from the Tar Sands?
It's hard to generalize because there's such a diversity of projects. From an operating cost standpoint, it's fairly low. It's probably in the $20 per barrel range. In terms of new projects, depending on the project, I would say in the $50 to $60 per barrel range, but it depends very much on the specific nature of the project that's being considered. And that break-even cost is coming down all of the time because companies are working very hard, obviously, in the current environment to reduce their capital intensity and operating cost performance.
So just in general, it's 20, 25, 30 bucks a barrel.
Sorry, in terms of where it's going?
I frankly wouldn't
speculate on where it's going to end up, but I believe that the oil sands industry, and if you look at the nature of the development that's likely to come forward in the future, I think you're going to see much less of the sort of large mining projects that are capital intensive, very capital intensive and very large and long lead times. You're going to see more of the in-situ type development, and that has a lower break-even cost that's more economic, and that's where companies are focusing in terms of trying to make sure that the industry remains viable. But there's quite a difference between the cost of a new mining project versus the cost of a new in-situ project versus the ongoing operating cost or break-even cost for an operating project.
What roughly are the percentages of the in-situ and the mining right now?
I think it's six. Did you have the number, Victor? 60-40? No, that's the resource.
Oh, 60-40.
Yeah.
60-50.
Yeah, it's just over 50, heading towards 60, I think, in situ.
And then 10% traditional extraction.
Yeah. Okay. So that, just to be clear on that, the there's quite a distinction between the way the resource is distributed, and that's the 80-20, from what is actually producing. And we're now at the point where in situ is a higher percentage of the overall production than mining is, and I think headed toward about 60%. I'm looking to Scott to confirm that number. So it'll, I think in the near future, be about 60% in situ, 40% mining.
Well, one last question. Just in general, what is the market price per barrel that you'd find on the indexes of Canadian?
It's highly variable. It's we're facing significant discounts on Canadian prices at the moment because of lack of access to markets. So we've been down in the $30 per barrel range, or if not less. The market price for WTI, the U.S. market price, is significantly higher than that. It's in the $50 to $60 range.
Yeah, it was 56 the other day, so yep. 57, something yep. like that.
Yep.
Okay, thank you.
The last time I looked late last week, it was 56, I believe.
So your comment prompted a question. As you said, I'm on a listserv every day, and I see articles about sort of world crude issues through my role in the California Air Resources Board. So what I read, which is sort of what you just confirmed, is that Canadian crude faces a substantial price discount because of its lack of access to market. And the translation of that is that, right, there is not sort of a quick and easy way to bring the tar sands to a wider global market, and hence the desire for the Trans Mountain Pipeline to basically take the crude from Alberta to the west coast of Canada and then open it up to greater world markets, whether it be the Pacific market, whether it be China, California, and of course, and the representative from Alberta at our, when we were there, mentioned that as a goal of the Trans Mountain Pipeline, that it would open up this supply to the large Pacific market and gain a higher price than what you get today. And everything I've read is that's been a major goal of the Alberta government, is to get a higher cost for this crude. So your comment, so that your view of the Trans Mountain Pipeline would, if it were constructed, it would allow this crude to reach a wider market and gain a larger price.
Yeah, I think I would summarize it this way. The United States has always been Canada's major market for oil, oil sands and otherwise, particularly given the growth in U.S. oil production. The U.S. is much less dependent on Canadian supply than it used to be. In fact, is exporting significant quantities of oil. And the Alberta government and Canadian government's objective and industry's objective is to diversify markets away from the U.S. It's not to say we're not going to continue to supply the U.S., we certainly are, but to diversify markets and in doing so alleviate the impact of market access constraints and get a higher price. But it's not just driven by higher price, it's also driven by the desire to diversify markets away from the U.S. to provide more choice, frankly, in terms of where Canadians can sell their
crude. Which would allow more extraction of by volume of tar sands out of Alberta.
Well, I'd say, I think even if you said to me that we are not going to increase, I mean, certainly the industry's objective and Alberta's interest within the emissions limit is to increase production. But I think if you said to me, even if we were not increasing production, would there be an interest in diversifying markets? I would say absolutely, because of the price
differential. The Pacific market, west coast of the United States and China.
Yeah, I think the primary target is Asia. Clearly, if you can get to Tidewater, there's a diversity of markets. And as you saw in Victor's chart, some of that oil goes to California. Some likely will go to California in the future if it's competitive in the marketplace. But I think the primary point is that access to Tidewater, access to a diversity of markets, serves any producer well of any commodity. You have more markets, you have more choice, and that's clearly part of what the objective is in the Trans Mountain Pipeline.
Okay.
We have three other speakers. Yeah. Do you want a question?
Yes, I have a question. So you said that you're moving more towards in situ production, but if the product is almost three times dirtier in the barrels per, in terms of the production, in situ than it is in mining, why are you moving towards more in situ? Because that's what we're concerned about is air regulators, not just the GHG emissions, but, I mean, you know, you go outside today and watch a bunch of people walking around with masks on. We're concerned about the dirtier toxins that are being exposed to members of our public.
Yeah, the final product that's produced is not materially different than what's mined. It's a function of how whether it's upgraded or not. So it's simply a matter, a different approach to recovering what is essentially the same product. Bitumen is bitumen. It's either buried deep and is amenable to in situ recovery methods, or it's shallowly buried. It's buried shallow and you can mine it.
So the you're saying the process isn't significant. Is that what you're saying?
Because saying the product that you're recovering is not materially different.
I know, but I'm not referring to the product. I'm referring to the process and the toxins
I would say the costs are generally lower for an in-situ project than a large mining project.
That's what I thought.
Yeah. I would say that the greenhouse gas intensity of in-situ is highly variable. It depends largely on the project. I would say that the potential to reduce greenhouse gas intensity for in-situ projects, because that technology is relatively new, is probably significantly greater than it is for mining, because the mining process is more mature.
But one of the things you're not qualifying when you talk about costs is healthcare costs, correct?
The health, there's no healthcare costs. I mean, I'm talking about the cost of recovering the product that we produce.
But if the process produces a barrel that's three times dirtier, that and our members of our public that live here in the Bay Area and these nine Bay Area counties are exposed to that dirtier product, then there should be healthcare costs in terms of the economic equation.
That's why I want to be clear that the product that shows up in the Bay Area is not necessarily any different if it's produced by in-situ versus mining.
Well, I think that we are very concerned about that. So that's, I mean, we're concerned about the process because in the end, it's for us, it isn't about the product. That's your concern. You got to sell your product to these companies. Our concern is that the process ends up affecting adversely the health of our citizens.
So I would say, just directly answer your question, I would say that the local health effects, local emissions, are not dependent on whether it is in-situ recovery or mined recovery. It's the product that shows up at a refinery in the Bay Area will not be materially different whether it's recovered through mining or recovered through in-situ.
So then the toxins are actually being, the people who are exposed to the toxins, are you saying, are the Canadian citizens rather than us who live here? Is that what you're saying?
When you say it's dirtier, can you just be specific about what you mean by that? The GHG intensity can be higher, but it can be lower.
Damien, you want to jump in here?
What I can clarify is I think, as we've indicated, that the Canadian crew that comes from oil sands extraction is, in terms of constituents, are roughly equal to that which we pull out of the Central Valley.
Yep.
And it's fairly heavy. It's got a lot of metals in it already. So it's just another source of, unfortunately, dirty crude is the best way for me to describe it. No disrespect, sir, but I just that's what we perceive in terms of the oil sands as they come here to the Bay Area. These refineries that we have were built many, many decades ago, largely to be able to refine fairly dense, heavy crude with out of the Central Valley of California.
Mm-hmm.
And so what the Canadian oil sands provide is really continuing that type of material here coming to the Bay Area. Mm-hmm. So as we as staff have indicated, we have adopted 1118, first of its kind type of step to be able to ensure that refineries and all large stationary sources are brought down to a relative risk of 10 in a million. That's first of its kind in the country. So that's an important step. But beyond that, we also have put in place measures to be able to monitor the crude that goes into these refineries. That's 1215. That's also an important step. And what Victor indicated to you, some of the summary, if you will, of the way we see things is we're going to need to make sure we monitor this situation and, in fact, bring it back to the board on some type of routine basis as to what the refineries are doing in terms of what they're availing themselves of, and are there necessary additional steps to be taken to ensure we protect public health here in the Bay Area. So that's kind of where the staff is coming from.
Okay.
Director Zane, does that make sense?
Yeah, I just wanted to kind of drill down, mm-hmm. so to speak, into the facts regarding the costs versus the toxins for the different processes of production, because we're talking about specifically tar oil sands today and some of the differences between mining and in situ. So if I'm hearing the company correctly, he's saying that we're going to be doing more in situ and sending you more in situ, and yet that process clearly is a dirtier process in terms of if you look at the toxins and the kilograms per barrel. So that's what I'm referring to. And you know, for me, it's like, okay, well, you can expose the Canadian citizens to the toxins and the wildlife, or you can expose us to the toxins. Either way, it's not good.
Yeah, and if I can just make a final comment.
If you would wrap up, and then we'll move to the next three.
I just want to be really clear that whether it's in situ recovery or mining recovery does not change materially the nature of the product that shows up in the Bay Area.
Thank you.
Right. Okay. The crude coming is functionally the same, whether it's extracted by in situ or by surface mining. So we understand that.
Okay.
And
yeah, I just want to be clear on that.
Right. That's a good point.
Thank you very much. Our next speaker is?
Sephora Bergman from Standard. Sephora, as I introduced earlier, is an adjunct professor at York University and is the International Campaigns Director for Standard. Sephora.
At the beginning, if you don't mind, Sephora, I would like to thank you for your time and your tour that you provided us in Vancouver. That was extremely informative for the chair and I.
Directions. I don't think we would have made it back to the airport.
No, we would have been lost. We'd still be there.
You can't read a map in that place.
Thank you. And thank you for having me today. I've been working on environmental policy in Canada now for a little over 25 years as an academic, as an advocate, and also, as Mr. Collier mentioned, as the co-chair appointed by Premier Notley in Alberta with Dave on the Oil Sands Advisory Working Group. For decades now, Canada has been working to align our environmental and our climate goals with oil sands and oil sands expansion. And there are a number of incredible initiatives that are going on in the oil sands. It's, as you see, a feat of innovation that Canada even has an oil industry from the oil sands. And there's a number of companies, Suncor included, that have some significant pilot projects to reduce environmental impacts. But those pilot projects are not being seen to reduce environmental impacts industry-wide. And that's the bottom line, is that they've been trying. You asked one of you about the reclamation and how long policies have been in place. Policies for reclamation in the oil sands have been in place since 1967. The industry likes to say that 10% of the oil sands have been reclaimed. Less than 1% has been certified reclaimed. And let me be clear from the outset, crude in California and what's coming from the oil sands is not the same thing on toxicity, in large part because you're not just getting crude, you're getting diluted bitumen. And in order to dilute that bitumen to be able to move through pipelines and get onto tankers, chemicals are added. What exact chemicals and what the impacts of those chemicals are, many of us do not know because the industry considers that a trade secret. So even the U.S. National Academy of Sciences, when reviewing potential marine impacts from bitumen on tankers, has said this is a huge problem. Dozens of scientists, including scientists here at Stanford, have published papers in the last year saying we simply do not know enough about the toxic impacts of bitumen and how it reacts in a marine environment. Increasing the expansion of the oil sands at this moment in history, when we all know the implications, especially those of you living here in California, of our climate challenge, and also the challenge that we have as industrial societies of trying to reduce cumulative environmental impacts on our air and our water and our biodiversity, is a huge mistake. Canada is arguing that we need the new pipeline and we need increased exports for our economy. But the fact is, we have a pipeline to Tidewater. We have an existing Trans Mountain pipeline that goes to Tidewater. Expanding that pipeline network, expanding the Phillips 66 refinery here in California and the piers that would allow more oil sands bitumen to come into the Bay Area poses a huge threat to Bay Area residents, both in terms of their health, in terms of their marine environment, and the overall impact that oil sands expansion has on our climate. I want to cover a couple of the issues that you've looked at so far from that lens of the cumulative impact of oil sands. I hope I'm using this right. So as some of you were able to see when you came to Canada, the oil sands lie under Canada's boreal forest, one of three largest intact forests left on the earth, the Amazon, Russia, and the boreal. And Canada's boreal are the largest intact forests remaining on the planet. The boreal is home to one of the largest concentrations of fresh water on the planet. It's also home to one of the largest concentrations of carbon. The boreal is also critical habitat for songbirds and waterfowl. And while that's, yes, a Canadian issue, it's also an American issue, because the birds that you see here in California nest and breed in Canada's boreal forest. If you haven't been to the oil sands, it's difficult to understand the scale of what we're experiencing. The oil sands as a whole is the single largest industrial project on Earth. To understand the scale, to look at one, I looked at last night trying to think of one metric that could help you really understand the scale of the operations that are going on in Canada. For the three largest dams in the world, the largest is the Three Gorges Dam in China. The two other largest dams in the world are here, rammed earth dams holding back our tailings ponds from the Athabasca River. That's the size and scale of what's happening in Canada. The board's responsibility is to protect the health of people in the Bay Area, an increasingly difficult task given the toxic smoke right outside the door, and of course to align with California's climate goals. The board passed a Keystone Resolution in 2013 encouraging the president to reject the pipeline because of tar sands impacts. Now is the time to re-up that commitment and prevent more tar sands from coming directly to the Bay. So we've talked a lot about the two different types of oil sands extraction in Canada, so I won't go into that more. But it is important to understand from a toxics impact that the mining, especially in Canada, is creating massive quantities of tailings, some of the largest, we think the largest, tailings ponds that exist on Earth. So last year, or in 2016, the tailings volume in Canada held in those ponds with rammed earth dams, unlined ponds in rammed earth dams, exceeded 1 trillion liters of toxic tailings. More than 90, so it takes about 2 to 4 barrels of water to make 1 barrel of bitumen after recycling. More than 95% of the water withdrawn for operations is too polluted for use to be returned to the river. Polluted water is stored in tailings lakes that now stretch 220 square kilometers. You can see them on Google Earth. That's about 85 square miles of toxic tailing ponds. About 250 million liters of tailings pour out a day into these unlined rammed earth pits. And now we know that they're leaking. Government studies show that they're seeping about 2.9 million USG per day. Inside these tailings ponds, you can find naphthenic acid, cyanide, phenos, arsenic, cadmium, chromium, copper, lead, and zinc. And also toxic air pollutants such as methane, VOCs, and H2S. These ponds are growing, not being reduced. Despite the industry's admirable goal of dry tailings from years and years ago, the size of the tailings in Alberta are growing. At one point, the government did put in place requirements, regulations, that industry reduce the size of tailings every year. Not a single company was able to meet that regulation, and so the government removed it. Seemingly less invasive, in situ extraction relies on vast quantities of heat, steam, that is heated by natural gas in order to separate the oil from the sand. And that's why in situ produces such a dirtier barrel. This is because in situ uses more natural gas to create steam to separate the oil from the sand. 2.38 billion feet of natural gas per day. On the way here reviewing this slide, I realized it's not 20% anymore. It's 29% of Canada's natural gas production goes to the production of tar sands. That's enough to heat 6 million homes every day. And that's why oil sands production emits 3 to 4 times more GHGs than conventional oil. Turning quickly to the impacts on biodiversity, both mining and in situ are having serious impacts on biodiversity. All of Alberta's boreal woodland caribou herds are considered threatened and under the Canadian Species at Risk Act, and unlikely or very unlikely to be self-sustaining. This is also true of wood bison, peregrine falcon, and many other species in the oil sands. The cumulative effects of biodiversity have not been managed. Recovery plans to ensure the recovery of these species are not in place. Woodland caribou have declined 50% over the last 10 years. We heard about reclamation this morning. So 94,000 hectares of land have been disturbed by oil sands mining operations. 104 hectares have now been certified by the government as reclaimed. Last week, the Alberta Energy Regulator noted that liabilities for the public in Alberta as a result of the impacts, the cumulative impacts of oil sands, have now reached approximately $260 billion in a worst-case scenario. $130 billion of that is identified because of the lack of reclamation, liability that taxpayers now hold. Turning quickly to air quality, oil sands are a major point source of air pollutants, such as nitrogen dioxide and sulfur dioxide. Growth in oil sands production will result in absolute growth in air emissions. Increased emissions result in air quality impacts for communities who reside in the region and beyond. Studies published in the journal Nature note that tar sands production in Canada is one of North America's largest sources of secondary organic aerosols, air pollutants that affect the climate, cloud formation, and public health. Like California, Alberta is no stranger to forest fires, which we now understand are made so much worse by the ravages of climate change. So any discussion of expanding access to Canada's tar sands must acknowledge the climate issues associated with increasing production in the third largest oil deposit on the planet. So pay attention to the gray here in this chart. Greenhouse gas emissions from oil sands production are expected to increase by 13% between 2050 and 2030. Yes, Alberta has placed a cap on emissions. Currently, emissions from the oil sands are about 77 million tons. The cap was set at 100 million tons. So that means that oil sands emissions right now, at this point in our history, can rise. There is no decline set for the cap. That means currently, under existing law, oil sands emissions can continue to be 100 million tons to 2030, to 2050. The emissions from the oil sands are inconsistent with Canada's climate goals, with Paris climate goals, and the recent IPCC report. There are no end to studies that have shown this. Dr. Mark Jackard from SFU, in the review of the Trans Mountain Pipeline Project, published a significant report with the National Energy Board looking at the impacts that the Trans Mountain expansion would have by increasing emissions in the oil sands. Stockholm Environment Institute, just a couple of months ago, released a report saying oil sands expansion will have a significant impact on whether or not globally we can reach our climate targets. Industry likes to argue that emissions are going down per barrel. Sorry, this graph will show you currently where oil sands, oil and gas's total is in red, oil sands is in green. 2015, what's projected for 2030 and 2050. So what we're increasingly seeing in Canada is that because oil sands emissions are so high and are being allowed to increase, the rest of the economy is having to struggle to contract faster in order to try and attempt to meet our climate targets. We do now have a pan-Canadian climate framework, and we are, and the government is creating a national price on carbon, and that's fabulous. But we're 66 million tons away from meeting our targets. And those targets are very weak targets, condemned by many countries around the world for a developed country. So industry likes to argue that emissions are going down per barrel. That's true. There are some projects that are having success in doing that. But overall, emissions have not gone down in a decade. Emissions intensity, because of the growth in situ, has gone up by 17%. So we talked already about where Canadian crude stands compared to Canadian oil sands stands, compared as one of the dirtiest oils on the planet, compared both to California and others. And so with this slide, I only want to make one point. It may look like it on the bar graphs that Canadian oil sands are similar to California oil, to California crude, but they're not. Diluted bitumen from the oil sands is not similar in composition to California crude. The mix of diluents with the bitumen creates much greater toxic impacts, air quality, and spill concerns. This slide shows you how different crudes get refined into different fractions of end products. Oil sands is an extra heavy oil that contains higher rates of sulfur. For this reason, refining oil sands typically requires refineries to be equipped with a coker or hydrocracking. Phillips 66 is doing this now. This can lead to some of the same sulfidation corrosion that caused the Richmond refinery explosion. Sorry. The result is that we produce more heavier ends, coke and pitch. It produces less quality products, such as transportation fuels. And heavy fuel oil is a substantial portion of the products derived from Suncor and Syncrude, and the 2020 IMO sulfur cap will dramatically reduce the demand for it. Between 2013 and 2018, the vast majority of tankers leaving Westridge Marine Terminal in British Columbia went to California, not to Asia, despite the fact that we have this pipeline to Tidewater. Of these, most went to Long Beach area refineries. Permitting Phillips 66 marine terminal expansion would dramatically increase the number of tankers threatening the San Francisco Bay. If the Trans Mountain expansion is built, 700% more tankers than today could export crude from Westridge. In 2016, a study that was published in the journal Frontiers in Ecology and Environment noted that there is basic information lacking about the impact that bitumen will have in the marine environment and on air quality. They studied 9,000 papers and said that the studies on marine and ocean environments were almost non-existent and said that there were grave concerns. For that reason, the scientists, including a marine biologist Stephanie Green from here at Stanford, oppose oil sands expansion and also the Trans Mountain pipeline. So finally, I just want to address this issue of spills. Dilbit spills have already repeatedly proved hazardous, not just to water environments, but also to air quality and to human health, including the U.S. largest on-land oil spill ever in the Kalamazoo River. Kalamazoo River tar sands spill from Enbridge Line 6B in July 2010. Over 1 million gallons were likely spilled. In July 2012, the cost of cleanup operations was estimated at $767 million. Dozens of residents went to hospital. Some say they still have health concerns because of the toxins that were in the air after the spill. Following the spill, the volatile hydrocarbon diluents evaporated, leaving the heavier bitumen to sink in the water column. 35 miles of the Kalamazoo River were closed for cleanup until June 2012, 2 years, when portions of the river were reopened. On March 14, 2013, the Environmental Protection Agency ordered Enbridge to return to dredge portions of the river to remove submerged oil and oil-contaminated sediment. Water and soil sample results from this spill, posted on both the Enbridge and the EPA websites, show elevated levels of arsenic, benzene, butene, butabenzyl, phthalates, ethylbenzene, iron, nickel, PAHs, sulfur, toluene, vanadium, and xylene, amongst other chemicals. Refinery emissions and explosions, like the sulfidation corrosion that caused the Chevron's refinery, pose a huge risk to the Bay Area. Increasing refinery emissions from a switch to tar sands oil by all Bay Area refineries could cause between 800 to 3,000 deaths over 40 years, health experts reported last year. Low-income communities of color near the refineries face a disproportionately severe mortality risk, 8 to 12 times more than the Bay Area average. Increasing tar sands refining means more high-sulfur crude entering the refineries, leading to both increased SOx, SOx and heavy metal emissions, along with the sulfidation corrosion of the kind blamed for the 2012 Chevron refinery explosion pictured above. In conclusion, increased tar sands production, transportation and refining threatens our air, water, biodiversity, climate and our health on both sides of the border. This board has an important responsibility to set direction for staff to ensure that your constituents do not bear the toxic burden and ensure that the Bay risk of refining products that are simply to be exported off your shores are not your constituents' risk. But more than that, to ensure that you don't support further expansion of one of the world's dirtiest fuels at this moment. If the smoke outside these windows tells us anything, it's that we live in challenging times. And at this critical moment in history, we're called upon to do everything we can to ensure our community's safety and security, to drive down risk, not to increase it, to work together for a cleaner and safer future. Thank you.
Thank you. One question.
Go ahead.
Just one question, Sipora, and thanks for helping set up some of those meetings in Canada. Appreciate that. I wanted just to ask about one thing, which I think I understand. When you talked about how tar sands are different from California crudes, you're talking about the chemicals that are added into the crude to transport it by pipeline from Alberta to the west coast of Canada. Because, I mean, typically the when we look at comparison, we look at gravity and we look at sulfur content.
Mm-hmm.
So you've introduced a different component that's separate from gravity and sulfur content, and that is the types of chemicals like benzene and others that are entered that are then which are then refined, go through the refining process when that crude gets to a refinery wherever it goes to get processed.
That's
so
correct.
It's that concern, right? I know one of the things we heard was that the industry has said those are proprietary and therefore don't publicly release what they add into the crude to make it flow by pipeline. And so no one's really been able to – we believe we know what some of the components are, but we don't know with certainty. And those are the toxics you're referring to.
Yes, and we certainly know what some of the toxic impacts of the refineries
are
that are currently refining. And we can test the air and the water around those refineries to know what toxins come out. But what chemicals are actually going in and what the makeup is, we don't know.
Right. Thanks.
Well,
There's I know even the staff have identified. We've heard whether there's – you gave some examples of what some of them are, right?
Yeah, I had a question. Yeah. Okay. So anyway, thank you, Dr. Ruhmann. This was great. I'm sorry I missed that second leg of the journey because I really would have enjoyed hearing and being able to dialogue with you. One of the things that concerns me is how is it possible that the industry can say that something that has an effect, a widespread effect on health and the environment, that that's proprietary? I mean, we sued our tobacco industry some 35 years ago over that particular response. Maybe it's time for the Canadian government to follow suit in terms of what we did with the tobacco industry. How is it that is? I mean, is anybody pushing back on that?
There has been in the past. So I struggle with that question, and also the results of some of these scientific studies on the cumulative impacts, including the government's own studies, that we are not meeting air quality standards, that the tailings ponds are leaking into the Athabasca River, that rare cancers are being seen downstream, especially in indigenous communities in Canada. And a number of health papers that have been reviewed by Environment Canada linking some of these rare cancers to the toxins that are in the waterways, in the wildlife that many indigenous populations rely on. And yet that continues. And, you know, I think the answer is that we have a significant amount of integration between the industry and between the government bureaucracy. And the oil industry is extremely powerful in Canada, has been a very important part of our economy. No one is saying that we should shut that down overnight.
Right.
But the question is whether we should expand it at this moment in history and how we clean it up. And I'm afraid we've been so focused on a nation, as a nation, and just looking at how do we increase production and how do we make sure that nothing stands in that way, that the economic implications have been of greater concern to the governments.
Well, and I would say that it's a false economic formula if you do not consider healthcare impacts. And it's not just what you know right now, as you mentioned, the additional deaths in the next 20 years, but it's also what you don't know. In terms of long-term impacts and disease. And, I mean, 3 years ago, people were still scoffing about climate change. What the hell? Now we're burning down as a state and being swept away with floods and hurricanes all over the southeast. So everything changes as soon as it changes. That's really the mantra. But the other thing, I guess, is that you brought up a real interesting question, and that is whether, if our mission of this air board would allow us to adopt an ordinance that prohibits more of the oil sands to being imported to the bay, because that product is having a very adverse, we already know that there's an adverse impact on people who often are poor and people of color and disadvantaged that live around these oil refineries. We already know that. We've talked about that. So maybe we could talk about what we need to do on our part to protect our Bay Area residents. But I think that you've given us a lot to think about and to talk about, and I really appreciate your whole presentation, and I hope we can bring you back, and maybe Judith could help put her on a retainer too. So, as our healthcare consultant.
Thank you very much. Teresa, and in terms of the local impacts,
Director Ross.
I was just going to say, in terms of the local impacts, I know that we're lucky enough today to be able to hear from Charlene Alec from the Tsleil-Waututh Tooth and Penny Opal, and I think they'll have a lot more information about the local impacts.
So my question isn't necessarily directed to you, but it's based on your information, and it follows on the whole issue of proprietary chemicals added to make the oils actually transferable. And we have, and this so it is really to staff, we have the Regulation 1215, which is to track emissions with crude slates. And how do we address the issue of proprietary additions to the crude slate in terms of monitoring what is being emitted?
Director Barrett, It's a great question. So as you know, we adopted 1215, what about over a year ago at least, and first of its kind, trying to essentially require these oil companies to tell us what are the constituents inside your crudes so we can track that over time. Ms. Berman raises the point about the diluents, and I want to take that back because I think it's a really good point. So I can better, we can better understand that portion. Does that make them that much different, right, as when they come here? But so keep in mind, what we're doing is we're tracking, right? We're not prohibiting crudes. That's we know that that's got fraught with some legal issues that Mr. Munger can talk to you about. But I think it's something we're going to need to look into and dive into a little further.
I agree, and I guess because this was the first time I heard about the fact that some of, even though we have you know, the right to ask what the crude slate is, you know, the proprietary blinders on the, what we can't look inside the bottle, that needs to be addressed, I think, sooner rather than later. Thank
I agree,
you.
Agree 100%, and it's, but it's a tough nut to crack. I'll just give you 100 heads up on that. Only because they hold this information very tightly. They believe that 1215, because as you all know, it's being litigated, is the camel's nose under the tent, if you will. They think they're going to go further, and frankly, it's, I think, the right direction to go to get a better understanding of these crudes coming into the Bay Area.
Director Ross?
Thank you. Briefly, and thank you for your presentation, Doctor. So I didn't get quite a clear answer, maybe I didn't ask quite a clear question previously, about the cost. I understand that the cost would be different of an in-situ barrel of oil and a mining barrel of oil from tar sands. Do you have any idea what the actual cost roughly would be per barrel? I know that they're selling it in the 20s, but what would be the cost of producing it?
You know, I think the reason that it's a difficult question to answer is that oil sands can operate at a very, very low level of cost because they don't have a choice. Because the unlike most oil drilling, the sunk costs happen in the beginning. So the enormous financial burden is way up front when they have to put in the infrastructure for the project. And then at that point, they'll take anything to get that barrel out because they've already put such a massive financial burden forward. So there's published costs. I mean, I think Dave would know better than I, but there's published costs that go everywhere from, people used to say it's $70 a barrel. That's what it is. It's going to be about $70 a barrel because, and that takes all the costs, the lifespan of the costs. But now we're seeing oil sands operations operate at such a low cost, and the reason is the sunk costs. And that's also the reason that Stockholm Environment Institute, in their new oil sands paper, says that it's very, very dangerous from a greenhouse gas perspective because of carbon lock-in, that once the infrastructure is in, once the expansion has happened, they have to get, they have to continue to produce in order to even get anywhere close to a break-even.
Which the reason I bring this up, and I'm curious, is we have a president that is so focused on import-export differences that China dumping steel, in a way, you know, tar sands are being, is technically, is oil being dumped into the market here at an exceedingly low price, which is subsidized because of the sunken costs, which is why I bring this up. And I'm wondering why that's never been focused on by Yeah. this administration, which seems very focused on that.
Well, it's worse. It's bitumen being dumped.
Right.
Because I think it's worth asking the industry why they're not refining the product in our own country.
I'm very concerned about the actual health impacts.
We're not refining it because it's so expensive to refine.
I'm very concerned about the actual health impacts. Sometimes I just look at the economics of it, and if we're subsidizing such an unhealthy product, or the Canadian government or somebody is subsidizing such an unhealthy product and dumping it into our economic markets, then I get concerned why that isn't being addressed by us.
There's no question that the industry is subsidized quite heavily in Canada. So the industry will argue about what is called a subsidy and what isn't. Using the international definition created at the G20, the IASD, the International Institute for Sustainable Development, has done a subsidy analysis and said that Canada is subsidizing anywhere between $1 and $3 billion a year, our oil industry right now. And the Trans Mountain Pipeline is a good example of that. The industry pulled out. Kinder Morgan pulled out because the business case for that pipeline has changed so much in the last 6 years as a result of demand softening, electric cars, et cetera. And they didn't have the buyers or the share, the investment. So the company itself pulled out. And then the government stepped in and bought the pipeline for $4.5 billion. And if they're going to do the expansion, that will be another $10 billion. And many around the world are saying that is actually a massive fossil fuel subsidy in an attempt to keep a very dirty industry alive in the climate era.
It's interesting. Well, thank you very much. It's a great point. It's interesting how we focus on Chinese steel and to some degree lately Canadian lumber of certain types, but this gets looked over. Thank you.
Soon to be Chair Rice.
Yeah, just really quickly, Jack, can you just clarify for me on 1215? As I understand 1215, our interest is to stay, understand what's come the feedstock coming into the refineries in advance of it going through processing or, you know, whatever the process is, so that we can ensure that the facilities are can handle it well without creating ill effects in terms of emissions.
Right, right. This issue of what the refineries essentially tap into to feed into their crude units is something that we've been concerned about for some time. You all have heard these concerns. And so we took this step with 1215 to try to understand what is coming in. It's really a constituency-based type of effort so that we can link that to their emissions profile. Brian, did you want to it is being litigated. I know you all know that.
But can I just – I think there's a direct link between that regulation and what we are – I mean, we're all about emissions and the public health. So to me, it's just like a direct sync up. And so it's so important that we actually know what that feedstock is, whether or not the ingredient or element is an active or inactive part, you know, whatever. I mean, mm-hmm. I just think it's so critical, and it really allows us to stay ahead of things. And then the second thing I just wanted to note on this discussion around cost and the subsidized cost and the cost per barrel, the really scary thing about the tar sands and this low cost of extraction or production is that in a market where the price of oil is going down per barrel, it becomes the resource and reserve that makes the most sense to extract across the industry, because other reserves are potentially more expensive to extract. So that's one of the scary things.
Gotta turn it on.
That was exactly Pete Erickson and other authors from the Stockholm Environment Institute's point in this recent paper that they published on oil sands and the impact on global climate, because they said that it could lead to greater lock-in and oversupply.
Director Sinks.
Yeah, just briefly, who was the Stanford researcher you mentioned that had been doing work? Thank you very much. And I had somehow the impression when I was there that when we visited that these tailing ponds were, it was getting harder and harder to find land to put these tailings. Does that produce a practical limitation on how much expansion can take place? Because it seemed like it was now taking years, even with chemicals added, to retire these ponds, or is it just growing without limit, and can it continue to do so in your view?
There's not significant retirement of the ponds. There's some plans in place from some of the companies to turn them into recreational lakes by allowing the toxins to settle, but that has not been reviewed. There hasn't been significant scientific review of that. And in terms of the restrictions, I think that would be true some like company by company, like for some companies, because of where their facilities are located. But if there's one thing we have in Canada, that's a lot of land.
Yeah. Yeah. So you talked about a significant amount of seepage. Where does the Athabasca go? Does it go to the Arctic?
Yes.
Eventually, through a whole chain of lakes that I was looking at. Okay. Mm-hmm. And finally, why are SO2 emissions much higher per barrel in situ? What's the differentiation there versus mining?
the natural gas that's used.
It's just the sheer volume of the gas that's used to heat up, right?
So there's SO2 in there that gets released as process of burning.
Yeah, natural gas has just a component of SO2 in it, and just the sheer volume amount that they use for everything just creates the SO2.
So there are some studies now in the industry to use chemical in situ instead of heating up using gas. But again, the environmental implications of using more chemicals to separate the oil from the sand are significantly in question from a number of scientists as well as the Miccosukee Cree and other indigenous nations. And those practices are also extremely expensive. So without costs going down, they're not yet adopted industry-wide.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. I appreciate staff's interest in looking at the chemicals that are being used and imported as a result of processing these. Thank you.
Thank you. And you can see why none of us listen to her. Yeah. Thank you, Sephora. Our next speaker.
Mr. Chairman, I'll just mention also that all of these slides are going to be put up on our website, including Ms. Berman's notes. She asked if she could have her notes associated with her slides, so we're going to have them on there as well. So just in case you all can't be here for the entire set of presentations, you'll have that available to you.
So our next speaker is Charlene Alec. Charlene is a council person for the Tsleil-Waututh Nation, and she's from Burnaby, which is where the terminus of the current pipeline and proposed Canadian pipeline north of Vancouver go out to the ocean. Charlene.
Wait a minute, Charlene. We have a special presentation.
Wanted to thank Councilmember Alec because she took me out in her own motorboat on the strait. That was my last day there to really see the beauty of that area, see the potential impact from where the pipeline would end up, and just appreciate learning about the area in which you live and hearing the context. I very much appreciated that, even though I was fearful we were going to run out of gas and not make our way back. But,
how ironic.
Remember that?
Yes, I do.
So I want to thank you for that. Appreciate that.
I'm not going.
You're most welcome. It was my honor. Simtalot kwana skwi talitsin at slewat osh haitsep awish Haha, Misteo, the Bay Area, Heitzep Awish, Haha, CIs, Bay Area Air Quality Management District, Wananawai, Tanishkwalawan, Tani, Te'i. Just paying my respects to the Indigenous peoples of this land that we are conducting our business on, and thanking them, as well as saying I have good feelings in my heart to be here, and thank you for your cherished work to the Bay Area Air Quality Management District leaders in this room, and thanking you all for this opportunity to come and share a little bit on behalf of our nation, Tsleil-Waututh Nation. We are the people of the inlet and a distinct Coast Salish nation whose territory includes the Burrard Inlet. The Tsleil-Waututh people occupied, governed, and acted as stewards of our territory prior to contact. And at contact 1792, at the British Crown's assertion of sovereignty in 1846, and continue to do so today. Our ancestors maintained villages in eastern Burrard Inlet and exclusively occupied and defended the area and intensively used all the natural resources there, especially marine and intertidal resources. The Tsleil-Waututh Nation has a sacred and legal obligation to protect, defend, and steward the water, land, and air, the resources of the territory. Our stewardship obligation includes the responsibility to maintain and restore conditions that provide the environmental, cultural, spiritual, and economic foundation of our nation and community to thrive. By 1972, the
cumulative effects of urban, commercial, and industrial development around the Burrard Inlet exceeded what is allowable under Tsleil-Waututh law, as indicated by the devastation of our subsistence economy, based largely on salmon, herring, clams, and the birds. It is essential to know both the historical context and the comprised environmental integrity that exists today in order to understand what our stewardship obligation requires of us. While Tsleil-Waututh is actively involved in responsible development in our territory, our nation cannot consent to new development proposals that further contribute to cumulative effects, threaten our objectives of our marine stewardship program, and delay or deny re-establishment of our subsistence economy. To do so, we would contrary to our stewardship obligation. Tsleil-Waututh has a stewardship policy that is an expression of our inherent jurisdiction and law. It mandates a review of all proposed water, land, resource policies, plans, and developments inside our consultation area. Assessments carried out under that stewardship policy provide us with the information we require to make informed decisions on whether we consent to a proposal or withhold support. The Tsleil-Waututh Nation has done some research and assessed the Trans Mountain Expansion Pipeline proposal in accordance with our stewardship policy. The assessment was required because many components of the proposed Trans Mountain expansion fall inside our consultation area and have the potential to affect us. For example, the Westridge Marine Terminal lies less than 2 kilometers across the water from Tsleil-Waututh Indian Reserve No. 3. In our findings, it provides a summary of our assessment of the components of the Trans Mountain expansion proposal that lie within our consultation area that we carry out under our stewardship policy. It describes the seriousness of the potential effects that the Trans Mountain proposal on Tsleil-Waututh title, rights, and interests. In our findings in our report, we provide a description of a representative set of Tsleil-Waututh title, rights, and interests threatened by the Trans Mountain expansion proposal. We also list some of the effects and consequences of the Trans Mountain expansion proposal on those title, rights, and interests, with a description of ways that our community anticipates being affected, including the likelihood of oil spills will increase if the Trans Mountain proposal is implemented. And because spilled oil cannot be cleaned up completely, the consequences are dire for sensitive sites, habitat, and species, and for the Tsleil-Waututh subsequent economy, cultural activities, and contemporary economy. Any delay in spilled oil cleanup response will decrease the total volume of oil recovered and significantly increase the negative effects and consequences. The direct effects of marine shipping add to the effects and consequences of spilled oil, amplifying the negative effects of the Trans Mountain proposal. The effect of the Trans Mountain proposal on Tsleil-Waututh cultural activities is as large as if not larger than its effect on natural resources. The Tsleil-Waututh Nation cannot accept the increased risks and effects and consequences of even another small incident like the 2007 Westridge or 2015 Marathassa oil spill, let alone a worst-case spill. Implementation of the Trans Mountain proposal will slow or deny achievement of the objectives of our marine stewardship program. It will also violate Tsleil-Waututh law because it will undermine our stewardship obligations.
Our report concluded that the Trans Mountain Pipeline Expansion Project proposal does not represent the best use of Tsleil-Waututh territory and its water, land, and air resources to satisfy the needs of our ancestors and the needs of present and future generations. It has the potential to deprive past, current, and future generations of our community control and benefit of the water, land, and air, and resources in our territory. The assessment recommends that the Chief and Council continue to withhold Tsleil-Waututh Nation's support and consent for the Trans Mountain Pipeline Expansion Project. I just needed to lay that base foundation of information from our independent assessment that we did in 2013 when the Trans Mountain Pipeline Expansion Project came into our territory. We consented to scientists and professionals doing an assessment, and we stayed away from calling it an environmental assessment because we believe that a project like this not only affects the environment, it affects our indigenous way of life, it affects the ecology, and it affects the movement of the land, water, and air. Just to address a couple of questions that were from the speakers before me, I wanted to leave this personal note about the air quality within the Tsleil-Waututh area. There is an existing Trans Mountain Pipeline that is right across the bay from us, and we have just now put in an air quality system within our village, and the effects that we see the smokestack running 24/7 all hours of the day, and we know that there is some effects because, you know, we're replacing and renovating our homes and our roofs from that, but also the deaths that we've experienced within our community, and our elders have been told not to eat our traditional foods of the clams, the crabs, and the salmon. But we've experienced a lot more deaths in our community, and we've got the Ministry of Health finally contacted us or replied to our request to have a report done and to see if it is because of the industry that you know, we're experiencing this vast amount of deaths by cancer and the air quality and that such. From day one, since the Trans Mountain Pipeline expansion came into our territory, Tsleil-Waututh has opposed this over inundation of industry within our inlet. I know we went out on the road and we had asked other communities, First Nations and non-nation First Nations communities, what they knew about this project. There are 150 First Nations communities along this pipeline project, and as the previous speaker had said, there are 43 that are on site. And what I know and what we have gathered is that there are these mutual benefit agreements with these 43 communities. And what I have learned is that that does not equal consultation, and it definitely does not equal consent. If it were to go to a community vote, this project would not serve their community as a benefit. As well as the Federal Court of Appeal, we challenged the process and we challenged the Canadian government on consultation, and we won in the case of decision makers sitting down at one table and having a clear conversation and us being able to share our concerns and the issues and the risks that we are being asked to bear on a huge expansion project like this. And we won that course as, along with the other First Nations that were alongside of us in that court case. That is my presentation, and I'm open for comments or questions. Heidsat Bauer, thank you all.
Okay. Thank you very much. Our last speaker, then, we'll save until we get all of you in.
Moving on, our final speaker today will be Penny Oakland. And Penny, Penny's our local representative from Idle No More. Penny, do you want to go ahead?
Hello, relatives of the board, of the staff in the room, including our fossil fuel industry relatives here. I want to thank John Gioia and Jack Broadbent and staff for meeting with the people that were here from the tar sands during the week of GECAS. It was a powerful meeting. I wish everyone could have been there for that. There were a lot of tears shed in that meeting from listening to the direct experiences of these people that have to suffer in their own traditional communities where they have lived for thousands and thousands of years because of the fossil fuel industry and the oil sands extraction. So I'm sorry that you weren't all able to be there. I want to pay my respects to the Ohlone people on whose territory that we're standing, who lived here and still live here, unfortunately, without the benefit of being able to follow their traditional indigenous instructions, their instructions that were given to them at the beginning of time on how to live in harmony and balance with the environment here that so many of us have forgotten, that has brought us to the time that we're living in right now. I'm a grandmother, as many of you know. I've spoken here many times. I see Chevron every single day from my house. What you may not know about our group, Idle No More SF Bay, is that we are all volunteers. In order for us to be here at these meetings, we have to take time off of work. As a self-employed, successful small businesswoman, I have to pay people to be in my business so that I could be here. We have organized the Refinery Corridor Healing Walks. I have more time today, so I want to let you know who we really are. We organized the Refinery Corridor Healing Walks from 2014 through 2017, connecting the refinery communities to one another. And that we walked over 4 years for almost 200 miles total. And there were over 1,100 Bay Area residents that joined us. We've conducted many prayers and nonviolent direct actions at the refineries along the bay, and we organized in San Francisco and Oakland the largest solidarity actions with Standing Rock during that period of time. I want to address, I'm sorry I couldn't see, the board member who spoke about corporate proprietary information here in the United States. Was that you? It was a woman. Pardon? No, I just want to talk about corporate proprietary information in the United States because we don't have that law in the United States. That was not a precedent-setting decision with the tobacco industry. When the BP oil spill happened in Louisiana, well, in the Gulf, the people in Louisiana were not able to find out what was in the dispersant that was released to dissolve the oil that was killing everything in the Gulf. They never found out because that wasn't a precedent-setting agreement. So there is the same type of problems here in the United States. I just want to say, and you probably all know, that the recent IPCC report stated that we have 12 years left to rein in the fossil fuel industry or face extinction, which we are probably facing anyway. And if you haven't read that report, the assessment for policymakers, I'm begging you to read it. Our lives are depending on that. We're dealing with fossil fuel exacerbated climate fires. John and I and other members here were in Sacramento last week speaking at CARB, at the Air Resources Board. The parts per million of particles in the air was 438 on those days. You couldn't even see the block ahead of you in that city. This is directly related to the fossil fuel industry. Oil sands mines have ripped off the boreal forest, which sequesters carbon, in order for the very thing causing climate disruption to be extracted. So this is a double whammy to climate. Additionally, the restoration project can never be done to bring back the original biodiversity of the forest and the ancient trees that have been destroyed as a result of the oil sands industry. So not only are we losing the forest that we need to protect to sequester the carbon, we're also supporting the oil, Canadian oil sands production, if we bring that here, that is adding to the climate disruption that is causing wildfires in California to kill the people that you represent. Of course, the fossil fuel industry is going to push the continuance of their product. That's their job. Have no disrespect towards them. That's what they're being paid to do. This is not the board's job. Your job is to protect us. As community members, it's our job to protect our community members and to look at the big picture of what is happening globally that's impacting the climate, which is now being exacerbated by the killer fires happening now in California, which are also taking away the trees, the forests, that sequester the carbon. We're in this insane feedback loop right now. We need policymakers like you all to have the courage to step beyond what is comfortable for you and to do the right thing so that we can simply exist, so our children and our grandchildren can walk outside and breathe the air without masks. The tar sands oil prices are plummeting right now. There was a, as is crude around the world. There was an article in Bloomberg.com on the November 14th that has a whole. It's all about how crude is plummeting in price right now. So of course our friends here from the fossil fuel industry are going to be doing everything they can to convince you to buy their product and to allow the refineries here to be processing it, as I'm sure that there are friends from Phillips 66 here who also want to bring that in. Allowing the local refineries to bring in more Alberta tar sands is like giving a drug addict the drug of their choice when their entire family is asking you not to because it'll kill them. The United States and the world is addicted to fossil fuels. They have a powerful lobby. They give millions of dollars to get candidates elected. And we know that that's destroying the climate. We know that some countries already understand this and are moving away from fossil fuels, like Wales and New Zealand and other countries around the world. Allowing any actions which allows the refineries to bring in even more toxic crude is akin to destroying the climate, and as we now know with the new IPCC report, it's going to lead us to extinction. We trust our relatives, our First Nations relatives up in Canada, to stop the pipeline, the Trans Mountain Pipeline. We know that they have said that they will risk their lives to do that. If you allow more tar sands oil from Canada to come into the bay, you are putting their lives at risk. You are adding to the problems that they're already facing. We need an immediate transition off of fossil fuels. And we understand that this regulatory agency has its hands tied in a lot of ways around climate mitigation. We know that you have your job to do. But one tool that you have are the refinery rules that can be utilized to rein in the refineries during the transition off of fossil fuels that must happen. So use those tools that you have. You have them. You can create refinery rules that help the refineries here locally transition off of fossil fuels. You can do that, right, Jack? Can you do that, Jack? Can it be done?
Talk
I see
to
you
us,
nodding your head, yes. I'm sorry, I always give Jack a hard time. We have a very interesting relationship. And last but not least, and this is about the fires. I just wonder why BACMED, why all of you didn't leap into action with providing masks, the N95 masks at police stations and firehouses and postal places.
We did.
I had thousands delivered up in Santa Rosa.
Some of us did.
Better
some
keep going, guys. Come on.
Well, thank you, but we
We're
didn't
losing
know
people.
That.
Yeah.
So the message did not get out. I mean, we didn't know that. So I don't know what needs to happen during the next climate fire, because there's going to be one where you can, like, let people know where they are and how we can get them out to other people. I've been horrified at seeing all of the children and families outside without masks. I mean, I've been a pain in the butt to my community members about that. So thank you for inviting me to speak longer than you normally do. And please do the right thing. Thank you.
Thank you. Okay.
So, Mr. Chairman, under my report, I'll cover the wildfire situation.
Okay.
Under the executive officer. We do have a question for Ms. Alec, actually, if she doesn't mind.
Yes.
We were going to ask her to further clarify the spills that have taken place up in the Vancouver Sound. There were two that you referenced, 2005, 2015.
Right. There was one at the Westridge Marine, which is directly across from our Indian Reserve number 3,
okay.
where most of our nation members live, and only 17% was cleaned up.
Mm.
There was a digger that was doing some renovations on a road, hit Kinder Morgan's pipeline, and oil spewed. This is the one in 2015, spewed 50 feet up in the air and wasn't turned off for a good 15 minutes. And
if you recall, Mr. Chairman, we heard about this incident quite a bit.
That reached the shoreline, and one of our elders had called the emergency response.
Okay. Thank you. Okay, we have some speaker cards. Let's open up public comment.
There's still some questions here from the board. I have a question.
Okay, do you want the questions before you hear
well,
from the
it's,
other people?
Because I think it'll help with the speaker cards. It's just a quick one. We've heard the staff refer to 1215, refer to 1215 several times today, which, by the way, is my birthday. So I like this rule a lot. And I just want to say these presentations were great, but what I would like from the staff is regular reports on how 1215 is being implemented. Because, and just kind of challenge all my colleagues to go in and read 1215, the rule, because it's strong. It says it's requiring refineries to report on composition data of imported crude oil. That's great. I want to make sure they're giving us that information. And then it's what we do with it. And then the second one is the monitoring. And this is the one that we've got to bring home to this board and make sure we implement it. And that is the monitoring of emissions to address public concerns about localized health impacts. That's great. So I want to just challenge everybody, go in and read it. It's a great rule, but it doesn't mean anything other than words on paper if we don't implement it, and if you guys don't get back to us and educate us about how you're doing this and where we're at, so we can push back on the industry and let them know that we will regulate them. We will regulate them and take care of the people who live here.
Okay. Thank you. Director Zane, now we'll get to public comment and see if there's any other questions. Go ahead.
I have Charles Davidson, Barbara Ryan, Greg Karras, Rochelle Towers, Janet Stromberg, and Claire Valderrama Wallace.
Wait, before we do, though, we had one person on 12D that I wanted to put first. Oh, that's public comment. I'm sorry. Go ahead. Come on up. About six. just line y'all up.
Thank you for going to Canada and for your presentation today. My name is Rochelle Towers. I am speaking as a member of 1,000 Grandmothers in the Bay Area. We have come so far that we already know that the dangers that are posed by bringing tar sands into our bay are something that we cannot accept. As our leaders, you have a historic responsibility at this moment. We are in a climate emergency, and we need emergency measures. We are going to hear and constantly hear that we're moving from an extractive fossil fuel economy and that we will be moving away from that. But everybody talks about how we can't do anything immediately. Everything is going to take time. And we know that that time is meant to extract every last drop of oil out of the ground and sell it, if that's possible to do. We need to reduce and not increase the kinds of emissions that this will bring into our atmosphere. I have heard names of chemicals that will be released, and these will be coming into the air and coming down through the bay in Canada and down the West Coast into our bay, and we will have about three times as many freighters and tankers that we have now, and the risk for accident will be, it's not really going to be a question of if, it will be a question of when. We have little tar sands from what I could understand from those tables, and why should we be trying to increase this? We know the risks that are involved. Right now in Rodeo, where the Phillips refinery is, if I have this information right, people there have the distinction of having being in the 1% of low birth weight. We don't need to increase the possibilities for that. The last thing I would like to say is that people should realize, the fossil fuel industry should realize, and anybody who's setting policy, that there will be fierce, organized opposition and resistance to trying to bring this into the bay. That will not lower your costs, and we need your leadership. Will you say no to this for all of us and yourselves?
Thank you. Next speaker, please.
Mr. Chairman, excuse me. I was asked to ask you how many minutes per speaker you'd like.
Two. Please.
Hi, thank you for allowing me to speak. My name is Barbara Ryan. I'm also with 1,000 Grandmothers for Future Generations. And I think the part for future generations is really important. You know, we're not going to be here that much longer, but I found myself saying to young people in the youth plaintiff's case, we'll always be here for you, and there are a lot of us. And that's how I feel, you know. I can't stand the discussions about it being gradual transition. Where is the turning point, given the UN report on the urgency of the crisis? Where do we turn the corner? Where do we go from going up to going down? We all know that this is full of toxic pollutants for our air, which is your specific mission. It's said that only a small amount is going to come through the Bay Area. Well, if that's true, why not say no to that right now? It's also said that the real goal is to reach the larger market in Asia, and that the real cost has already been paid by the oil industry, so they want everything they can get. So why not be on the correct side of history? Right this minute, Andrew Cuomo, who divested in New York, called it reprehensible to make profits on oil at this point, given the nature of the climate crisis. not just for Indigenous people, not just for the people in Rodeo, not just for those of us who wore masks to get here today, but for everyone on the planet. Bernie Sanders calls it morally repugnant to make profits at this point on oil. I have to say that I agree with him. Governor Brown spoke to Channel 5 yesterday after Trump visited, and he made it clear that these wildfires are exacerbated by climate change. They're the new normal. They're going to get worse, and they're going to get more frequent if we keep going in this direction. We just all have to put our bodies on the machinery and turn this around, and you guys have one very important function. I have heard that incremental changes in Phillips 66 have already been approved for their expansion project, and I'm surprised at that because every time I come here, it seems very understanding of all this. So I'm hoping that will never happen again. Thank you for listening.
Janet? You're going to have to speak louder than that. Janet, do you want somebody else to go ahead of you?
Yes, I've asked for a slide from the Air District's presentation, and particularly call your attention to 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, bullet, no, slide 17, please.
This is slide 17.
It's the other presentation, probably. Janet, can you start talking while they find
Sorry.
It?
Well, it's this one. Yes, thank you. And I want to extend a lot of thank you for you all going to the tar sands in Canada and to everybody that attended and to the presentation today. I have, this is not it. Oh, yeah, okay, the second to the bottom bullet, regulatory changes may be necessary if emissions increase. The question is, why wait for them to increase? The Air District has the capacity right now to inquire about
Okay, go back to the back and start over again. Come on up, Greg. Give her a break.
Keep the same slide, please. Greg Karras, Communities for a Better Environment. I'm a senior scientist. I want to talk about the second point on this slide because it's important. Many of you have asked questions around that during the presentation, the excellent presentations. Thank you very much. And because I have some expertise on this. I'm going to tell you why, but first, just you all know what motor oil looks like, right? Now, I understand you have packets in front of you with bitumen in it. If you haven't opened them, take a look at that. I'm guessing you can tell right away that if you're going to make that into gasoline, you'd have to do some additional things that you wouldn't have to do to motor oil, right? Need to process it more intensively. That takes more energy, which refiners get by burning fossil fuels. The more fossil fuels they burn, the more carbon they emit, and all of the toxic and criteria pollutants that are combustion products, including PM, all of it. It's pretty simple, right? And if you, another way to put it is if you took that stuff in the envelope, and you mixed it with lighter fluid so it was just exactly as heavy as gasoline and had just exactly as much sulfur in it as gasoline, Would you put it into your car? There's obviously a difference between diluted bitumen and conventional oil, or even heavy oil, which is some of the bad oil that's refined from California. This is worse. And the reason I know this is that I have seen since 1986, when California oil peaked and companies started going to things like high selenium oil that polluted the bay, and they denied it for 25 years until finally we published peer-reviewed work showing that this is true, and then the academics could publish and they all supported it. The companies had denied it for 25 years,
Greg, can you
and CBE had to do that work. I want you to challenge your staff to honor a longstanding request made almost 10 years ago when we published our peer-reviewed work. Let us present it to you.
Okay, thank
staff
you,
hasn't
Greg.
Yet.
Next speaker, please.
Hi, my name is Nancy Feinstein. Thank you very much for your trip and your continued efforts to get to the bottom of all these issues. The fossil fuel industry is increasingly savvy. Many no longer just say, don't mess with our business. They now claim they're trying to improve their practices, lower toxic impacts, and it's harder to see the ways in which our interests are actually in conflict. That they're finding community groups to support them. You can always find people who can be found to be incentivized to support initiatives that benefit provincial interests. That doesn't mean that they represent all those communities. The fossil fuel industry has become increasingly good at using indigenous voices to support them, dividing indigenous leadership from each other, and using the increasing public respect, recognition, and trust of indigenous traditions, practices that protect the planet, using this growing respect to further the fossil fuel industry's mission for increased profits, not the environment or indigenous sovereignty. The fossil fuel industry habitually pits the interests of some against the other. For example, the answer to the question that was raised here, pitting our interests against the local communities in Alberta. Climate change is a frightening and often overwhelming challenge, and each of us wants to feel like we're part of some incremental change. But what we need to develop the muscle to do as individuals and groups and representatives such as yourselves is develop the muscle to say no, to try to begin to find the alternatives. This is not going to be easy, but each of us is it's very seductive to feel like, okay, some change, some incremental change is better than no change. Not now, too late. Now the muscle that we need is to say no, and please represent us in doing that. Don't support any refinery requests to increase capacity.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Next speaker, please.
Good afternoon. My name is Claire Valderrama Wallace. I'm a mother. I'm here with my 5 and 7-year-olds. I'm a nurse. I teach community health nursing at Cal State East Bay. When our systems are built and maintained around poison, toxicity, all forms of racism, and ongoing erasure of minoritized peoples, and using so many forms of harm, so much needs to change. No industry is more important than the health of our communities, our children, generations to come. No industry is more important than our relationships between each other, between the land and the air and the water. Monitoring is not enough. We need more action. As someone in academia and as a nurse, I am told constantly I am a professional. Well, I would like to say and invite you all to join me in saying anyone with a claim to power, who are we responsible to and who are we answerable to? Thank you.
Thank you. Next speaker, please.
Hi, board members. My name is Richard Gray. I'm with 350 Bay Area, and I'm also a grandfather of 5 children, almost all of whom are not going to be in their 20s by the time 12 years rolls around. We're now in the sixth or seventh year of drought. We've seen what's happened so far. I really hate to think what kind of life they have ahead of them. In this world. What I heard today from the representatives from Canada is that this is an issue that is going to get bigger and bigger and bigger thanks to the Canadian government's subsidy. And so where is the potency to be able to turn this around? What I heard from the staff, I think, is, you know, they don't even know what the diluents are that are being added to this stuff that is coming into the Bay Area now. And it seems likely that it's going to get, you know, there's going to be a lot more volume coming in. Who has the potency to find out what's in this stuff that is affecting our lives and could have a major impact if we ever have a spill, not only to the water, but to air quality? What other industries are there that you deal with that that have this kind of ability not to respond, to say what their industry is using? Is this only the oil industry? Why do they have this right to withhold information? I don't understand it.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Greetings. My name is Charles Davidson. Phillips 66 is one of the most heavy crude processing refineries in the United States. Their so-called complexity index is one of the highest in the U.S., meaning that they are especially capable of manufacturing high-quality gasoline by processing low-quality, very inexpensive, high-sulfur, extra-heavy crudes such as Kern County crude or Canadian tar sands diluted bitumen. The California Energy Commission erroneously states that Phillips 66's complexity index is 11.6, which describes a refinery which can only process middleweight crudes, not bitumen. In contrast, the refinery's own website advertises a complexity index of 14.3, and this is before the two recently in-play projects, that is the propane recovery project and the hydrocracker increase, are completed. The highest complexity index of any refinery in the U.S. and one of the highest in the world is 15.1 at the Detroit Marathon Refinery, which is more or less a pure tar sands refinery. The Global Oil Complexity Index from the Carnegie Oil Climate Index from the Carnegie Endowment shows that the refinery level midstream greenhouse gases from Canadian bitumen are the highest globally. Together, the hydrocracker project and the propane project amount to an increase in extra-heavy crude processing of about 15% or more of the refinery's total capacity. I will send that to you in a letter. The proposed massive wharf delivery expansion project has been made especially contingent upon San Luis Obispo County's rejection of admitted tar sands dill bit in their plan by crude by rail plan for delivery to their twin connected Phillips 66 refineries. It's really two refineries. Another point, this is very, very important, according to California Offices of Spill Prevention and Response, I just have one more sentence. There is no spill response plan in California for an aquatic dilbit spill where the bitumen would sink without recovery, and worse, the spill lightweight and highly flammable diluent would then rise up as a plume floating over the bay and potentially over Rodeo, Crockett, or Vallejo, or refinery workers. The people of Vallejo have already suffered two toxic wharf releases within the past 2 years, and thank you very much.
Next speaker, please.
Okay. Thank you, everybody, staff, and audience. I first of all want to thank the Ohlone people of the Yolamu Nation for allowing us to be here on their land. They're not federally recognized and have no ability to benefit from whatever benefits Indigenous nations are allowed. And I also want to thank the Indigenous representatives from Canada, who are on the front lines, and I'm truly apologize for what you've had to suffer at the expense of our addiction to fossil fuels. Here in California and in the Bay Area, we are still feeling the effects of the gold rush, with the mercury that's washed into the rivers and down into the bay, and we're not supposed to be eating fish very often, which was once plentiful and an important source of protein. I'd like to know if you can provide information to who are the investors, exactly who are these investors that benefit from these tar sands projects. Do you have that information broken down for us? Because we need to change the whole investment model around to invest in our future. I'm a grandmother. I want my grandchildren to have a future. When I see the air and experience the air like this and know that the waters are polluted in so many places, I wonder what's the future for them. You must all wonder for your families as well. We've got your back. Let's all together do what we can and prevent any more refining of tar sands. Thank you very
much. Thank you. All right, Janet. No pressure. No notes.
Thank you for a second choice. I think I'm better off without glasses. Two
Thank
comments.
Thank you, Janet.
One, I recall that in the 1990s, Dow Chemical and DuPont Chemical used to tell Air District engineers that their formulations were trade secrets. And it was determined that the engineers needed that information in order to calculate emissions. And that's been dealt with decades ago. It's true that the public is not entitled to the trade secrets, but the air quality engineers are very much entitled to them. And it's always been a mystery to me why it took so long for the Air District to examine what's in the upstream crude, what the composition of the crude is. And now that that information is starting to come in, it seems to me that it's quite reasonable to look into creating a rule that limits what's allowable in the upstream crude. Already, sulfur concentration is limited. You can't use oil or natural gas or other products that have higher than minimum levels of sulfur. So that the same thing could be applied to some key criteria of upstream crude, and then that would be a way to avoid the impacts of tar sands. So maybe I'm just simple-minded because I'm an engineer and I'm very practical, but that's what it looks like to me. Thanks.
Thank you, Janet. Any other speakers? Okay, seeing none, we'll close the public comment period.
Mr. Chairman, I just want to point out that I think Mr. Collier does have information for us on the diluent, and no, I didn't want to extend this discussion any further than it needs to be, but we'll follow up with Mr. Collier on that.
Good.
And provide that information.
Thank you very much.
On our website.
Go ahead, Shirley.
I just want you guys to put some thought into the request I made about kind of the reporting on 1215. We could have some type of regular reporting. There's a lot in 1215, and I think it behooves all of us to be educated on the information that we're collecting.
That's a great point, Director Zane, and it's like you said, it's what you do with that information. So our plan is that to really turn it into a some type of routine monitoring back to the board through a committee, and I'll work with the incoming chair to figure out how often that needs to take place.
Okay, that would be great. Thank you.
Go ahead, Tara.
First, I want to thank our guest from flying all the way from Canada down here to present to us. I found this conversation very, very illuminating, and thank you for our Suncorp representative also for sitting there and taking it this entire time. The thing that strikes me is, we're in the business, obviously, of reduction, right? I mean, we're trying to reduce health risk. We're trying to reduce air pollution. We're trying to reduce emissions. And so when I see a chart that says, well, we're going to kind of go in the opposite direction when it comes to the process and manufacturing of oil sands, whether or not it fits within a cap, it seems to be almost antithetical to what we're trying to accomplish here within this agency within the Bay Area. And I do feel the frustration now that there's been so much talk and so much energy about how we need to go fossil fuel free, how we need to go diesel free, how we need to have these climate action plans within the Bay Area and within the nation and within the world if we're ever going to kind of get a handle on climate change. To not have specific details anymore and to have businesses standing up saying, we believe in climate change, we believe in the human causation of climate change, but not to have specific action plans of what that transition is going to be. Like, I think we're past that point of being able to say, we're with you, but how are you with us? And then to see that increase of production flies right in the face of that, whether or not the economics is there, whether it isn't. And so this is an informational item, so we're not going to take any action here, but this presentation and this kind of discussion today has really illuminated, like, there does need to be a stand at some point. And just like we're taking stands within this agency, within what we're doing here in the Bay Area, within what we're doing within our environmental communities and our impacted communities, we're going to have to take a stand here also at some point. And I have to say I'm reaching that point of frustration where that line is getting drawn.
Member Joya.
Thanks for everybody coming from those from industry, those from the First Nation community, environmental community, and let me say for those who have read about the tar sands issue, there is no replacement for going up there and seeing it firsthand and talking to all the different stakeholders, and I thought it was very educational, very worthwhile. And I know this trip originally came out of a discussion that I know I had with Penny about when we were talking about this and suggesting that it would be good for the board and staff to sort of see that issue. And so I'm going to make just a couple comments wearing both my Air District hat here as well as my hat on the California Air Resources Board, because I think what's happening in Canada and the potential for the exportation or the greater exportation of tar sands has greater implications for Canada, for the globe, and for those of us here in California and the Bay Area. And obviously in our role here, we are most focused on implications here for the Bay Area. We do care about, obviously, what happens in Canada. And in my role on the Air Resources Board in implementing the state's climate change law, what happens around the world. Clearly, and I think there's really a connection here, the pipeline, the Trans Mountain Pipeline, and the oil sands extraction. It is clear to me, having heard it directly from the Alberta government and industry, having heard it in reading just many, many articles by those who watch Canadian oil industry, it is clear that the pipeline, a Trans Mountain pipeline, is intended to bring this supply of dirtier crude to a larger global market and in as cheap way as possible, because there are infrastructure limitations, as folks acknowledged. And what that means is if the pipeline gets built, there will be a large amount of this crude that enters the Pacific market by tanker. And what does that mean? I think while it doesn't stop the investment in renewables and clean technology, flooding the larger global market with more of this cheaper, heavier crude will tend to be a disincentive in investment in clean technology globally. So it will slow. It's not going to stop, but I think it's going to slow the transition to cleaner energy. This is one of the largest oil reserves in the world. And so having all of this new product enter the market will slow our global and California's battle against climate change. Again, won't stop it, but it will slow it, which will have its own negative impacts. Second, the impacts in Canada. We've seen, can't dispute the negative impacts both that occur in Alberta at the extraction site and in British Columbia near Vancouver and Burnaby, where a pipeline with increased tanker traffic would occur. And of course, then wearing our own sort of hat here in the Bay Area, the potential for increased emissions at those refineries that process this. And I think that's where we want to, in terms of our district here, focus our efforts and fully quantifying and understanding that, because that's the health sort of relationship that many, and I know surely you've talked a lot about, is so how do we fully understand and be prepared? Because refineries currently have permits to operate at particular levels. And most basically those refineries in most cases are not emitting at those permit levels. They're below those permit levels. So that means if while we do have rules like 1118 that are designed to lower toxic emissions to lower health risks, so that is important to implement, that if you're operating below your permit level, if you are then bringing in a type of crude that results in greater emissions, then that means there's the potential that your emissions will go up and you'll still remain within your permit levels, but your emissions will be higher. And I know we're working to stop that. Clearly, that's why we passed 1118. So I think that's the reality we want to face, Jack, is that we don't want emission levels to go up. Our trend is to have them continue to go down, right? And I think the good rules that we've passed have resulted in improvements, and I want to acknowledge that. The rules we've passed have resulted in improvements in air quality and have decreased emissions, but we do not want to reverse course, right? That's the worry that I have, is that this crude has the potential to reverse the course or the trajectory that we've been pursuing, which is a decrease in emissions at barrier refineries. So I think that's why this trip was well worth it, and it's given us more of a perspective on how we look at this issue.
Director Sperring?
Thank you. You know, first I want to thank Mr. Collier for having the courage to come down. You've outnumbered with the speakers, obviously, and so thank you. But it was interesting to hear your point of view. I want to thank my colleagues for taking this trip. You know, when I first heard about it, I was really questioning why you were going. But as I see this data, I think it was absolutely imperative and important that you did do this trip and to bring back this information. You know, today's presentation, if I go away with anything, it's a real sad commentary on the Canadian government, you know, as you take a look at this. And, you know, I think we certainly have to measure everything. You know, as we get data, we have a tendency to just focus on one little thing. You know, when you talk about the, you know, boreal forest, you know, it's 1.5 billion acres, you know, and this project is just one little dot, you know, in comparison to that size. And so everything is relative. And, you know, I work real hard to separate the people that just hate fossil fuels, and even if it was clean, if it had no impact on the environment, they would still hate it. And then there's people that are concerned about the air quality advocates. Those are the ones I listen to the closest, and many are my constituents, which I have to respond to. But, Jack, one of the impressions that's being left is that if these tar sands come into the Bay Area, we are just going to ignore the output of the air quality of the refineries. I mean, which is just not the case. I mean, we have standards. We continue to upgrade them. We're more stringent with air quality. And so I think it's really unfair to leave under the impression that because you import any particular product that we're going to look the other way on the emissions of the refineries. And I think it's important that you, Jack, you take just a second to clarify that, because that's the impression that's being left. Now, you know, tar sands, I mean, if you want to make a case against tar sands, there's a hell of a lot more reasons than, you know, just what we're refining when you look at this thing, you know, the impact that it's having on the environment. But I think it's real important that we don't leave this room thinking just because you're importing a certain product that our air district looks the other way. And, I want to say that I'm probably one of the oldest guys in the room. You know, when I hear people get up and say, oh, what kind of planet are we leaving our kids? I mean, that's just so bizarre. I mean, just the limited time that I've been on this planet, I think we've done a hell of a lot of good things for this planet. And I think this next generation is going to do much greater things we are. If you measure the air quality in the air district over the past 30 years, that's one hell of an improvement. Do we have a lot more to do? Absolutely. And we're going to continue to do it. I think people are becoming more aware of these things and the technology that's coming around and that really will serve many of the goals and objectives we have on environment and quality of life. But it's not just simple to just make the statement, you know, you're not measuring health care. You know, if our seniors and people with disabilities can't get to the doctor, you know, with many of the vehicles that we have, you know, the impact on their health is much greater. And so there's a lot of ways of measuring all of these impacts. But, Jack, I would appreciate you just commenting on, you know, what we're importing and why, you know, we do not lower our standards and we're continuing to raise them.
So, Director Sparing, it's a great point. And as you know, what this board has done over time is we have put in the most stringent standards on all the different processes that are not only at refineries but all stationary sources. But if you just focus on the refineries, all of their different processes, their boilers, their furnaces, their valves and flanges all have to meet very stringent requirements. They're rate-based, right? They're typically not total amount of emissions coming out of the facility, but instead are essentially either a pounds per barrel input or some other rate-based. And so what we're continually concerned about is, okay, what goes into the facility, is that going to potentially increase the overall emissions? And so you're right. We're going to remain concerned about this. That's why we adopted 1215. And other type of measures. We're going to make sure we monitor this situation, and we're going to come back with options for you if they do see emissions being increased overall by these facilities. But we're certainly not going to be walking away. We very much care about what goes into these facilities, and of course, we very much are concerned with what comes out, the overall emissions, on a per process basis and overall. And you've got rules and regulations that have been adopted by this district that are the most stringent in the country, and you all know this. I'm just singing to the choir here. But so it is something we need to monitor, and we're going to continue to do that with you all throughout the course of the year. Hopefully that answers your question.
Thank you. I'd like to add a couple things before we move to public comment. First of all, I think it was outstanding that you invited the people you did today. I was really looking forward to having Sephora come up here, or is that down here? I can't remember what our elevation's difference is. After listening to her in Vancouver, I see it differently. I think that Sephora and Mr. Collier can talk. She showed me in Vancouver she could talk to anybody, except for the people that were yelling at you that day. But outside of that, there are some very level-headed people that are looking for solutions. And it's very difficult with the amount of money that's in it and the amount of information that's coming out. And I think what I saw between Burnaby and First Nation and Sephora and a lot of people up there, that they may be able to work this out if they keep talking. What really has me concerned, and I didn't hear anything about it, and it's the main reason I wanted Sephora to be here, is because she even made this statement today, as you look outside and you look at the smoke. We can't put this one on the refineries. This is fires. When we were in Canada, there were 600 fires around British Columbia and Washington. Now, we can keep saying that it's caused by climate change, but that doesn't put them out. And I really think somewhere along the line, when we realized that those 600 fires were felt here, when we came home in August, the smoke came with us. The fires that you see now in November is really serious. Somebody needs to come up with a solution. Bill Dodd has 901. 901 is California. That doesn't do anything for what's going to happen in Washington, B.C. Somehow, some way, there needs to be at least a little focus on how we're going to put these fires out. Because when I asked how they're going to put them out, well, they can't. Nature's not taking care of anything anymore. This is a different world. So I would just leave you with that. I think we got a lot of good information. There's going to be a lot of follow-up on it. I thought we were out of it, but Director Sinks, you have a last minute before we go to public comment.
And then more.
Okay.
More. So I really appreciated the speakers coming today. I appreciated going on the trip and seeing the magnitude of the mining surface mining and all. I'm obviously very concerned about the carbon content of this. Not all gallons of, not all tanks full of gasoline are created equal. I get that from this. And yet, it seems like the tools that we have in our tool bag as an air district to address this don't go to carbon, but they go to toxins. So understanding what's coming in is good. We have 1215 for that. We, if we could get some understanding of the diluent, that would seem to be useful because there are a lot of reasons to know. What about a spill? What about how it gets consumed once it's in the refinery with that diluent included? But our primary tool here for mitigation, given what's come down from the state in the last year and a half, is health impact, correct? So, and it seems like of the toxins at least, the toxin rule 1118 is our strongest measure, and as you said, it's a leading measure that we've taken. When does that come into effect? Can you remind us for the refineries, and are there other significant rules that will continue to help us mitigate emissions from refineries?
So the 1118 is ongoing in terms of its implementation. The refineries are in what's called phase one, and we're working through some emission estimates of certain processes. That being said, we're moving forward. Damien, do you remember when most of
yes.
the
refineries? All of the phase one facilities, you've directed us to have them complete by 2019, the end of 2019, the HRAs. There is some outstanding litigation on this particular regulation, but we are now preparing some of the informational requests for those facilities. So we expect to be on time.
But Director,
by the end of 2019.
Yeah, the end of 2019 for 1118. But I just want to point out there's this BARC schedule that we're going to be bringing before you at your next board meeting on the 19th of December. That includes a series of refinery measures. Those are on top of the ones that we've already adopted and are in place over the last several years. So it's not like our work is not done. It continues, and you'll hear more about this at your next board meeting.
Okay. Thank you. Director Mitchoff?
Thank you. I, too, want to thank everyone who made a presentation today. It was very enlightening. My colleagues have spoken to a number of points, but I did want to address something Mr. Hudson just said about fire. Just coming here today, and I heard it over the weekend, there's two ways, well, I'm sure there's more than two ways, but the two major ways of dealing with our fire threat is to get rid of the underbrush. And that either means controlled burns, which I don't know that what's been brought up is that we have a number of regulations in place. So it's sort of ironic, in a good way, I guess, that controlled burns probably are not the way to go, at least in the Bay Area, or even in our more pristine areas. But that's going to have to be looked at. But the other side is our environmental friends are going to have to get on board with the idea of going in and doing the cuts and letting the lumber industry and timber industry go in, because if we're not going to do the controlled burns, then we have to get rid of that brush. That is what's causing this fuel. And then, of course, the unfortunate many impacts are air quality, but then we're losing the trees that can do the sequestration of the carbon. And that's not going to come back for many years. So, and of course, the third issue is water. And as you know, that's a big issue for me. And with so many trees, it's taking up so much water. So I know it's not our mission, but I think we all need to be educated and informed on the issues of how we're going to deal with a number of issues. They all interrelate. As you said, Dave, climate change can account for some of the fires, but and that may be because of all of our use of fossil fuels, and you know, it's sort of a vicious circle. But I would exhort everyone to pay attention and listen to those conversations, because I think we're going to have,
My personal opinion is we've got to go to cuts. And in order to do cuts, we can't have everybody saying, oh, but you got to save the trees. You got to save trees, but you don't have to save every tree. And that's what we need to do. So that's my 2 cents for today.
Director Joy.
So I want to make sure sort of we leave today with some, you know, what is our sort of any steps going forward. And I know Rule 1215 really is intended to really collect more data from refineries about both crude slate going in, but also the monitoring aspect. And I know some of the oil companies have sued, not all, I think, but some of them sued on that, right? So it's in litigation. But we're still moving forward. There's been no stay of the rule, so we're still moving forward with implementing the rule. So can you talk to us again about the time frame of when we're collecting sort of the emissions data? It is emissions tracking. And again, just to note, because I think, credit is due where credit is due, the regulations we've passed to date have resulted in emissions going down at barrier refineries. That's not to say that there isn't still work to do and the need for continual decrease in emissions. And that's why this rule and Rule 1118 are important. But so talk about the time frame and sort of what we're doing next. What are the talk about the triggers for the monitoring and when that starts. And that's separate from, our, of course, AB 617 monitoring.
Right. So 1215 requires constituent information to be provided to us of their crude inputs. And that, even though it's being litigated, it hasn't been held, like you indicated.
Yeah, there's no stay.
So there's no stay on it. So we're actually, and have been, moving forward to implement it. It requires community, or what I like to think of as neighborhood monitoring.
Tell us the dates, though. Refresh us on the dates of when all this is going to happen and where we're going to start collecting data. I think we all know it's taking a while, but what's the date?
We've already collected 2 rounds worth of data in terms of the overall reporting from each of these facilities. We are looking at the crude constituents as they go in, and we can do that on a monthly basis.
Are the refineries providing that information?
Yes, they are.
On a confidential basis?
Yes, and our inspectors go and
visit. So you're getting the crude slate information?
Yes, we are. Okay. What has been kind of holding up the publication of that information is we are still working with the refineries on emission factors around heavy liquids. We expect that study to be complete in the first quarter of next year, at which point all of this data will become publicly available. But the refineries are continuing to report. We are continuing to monitor, and we are continuing to look at that information. It's just without those emission factors, we can't make some of the final calculations for this to be an entire and complete data set that folks can understand and really use.
So when will we be? When will we and the public start getting the first round of emissions data?
And we expect that to be at the end of the first quarter
of next year.
Yes, principally because we need to complete that.
And there will be data collected over what period of time?
It would be 2 years' worth of information, I believe.
Okay. So that'll be sort of our, quote, baseline in a way. Although we've had data before, this is this new round of more sort of robust data. So this will be our baseline as we look at measurements going forward.
It's a baseline for 1215, as you said.
Yes.
We have other information that we also.
Yeah, it's not like we haven't been collecting data and monitoring. Right. We have. It's just this is under 1215. This will be the baseline.
We expect that this will be a finer grain resolution of data, so better data.
Okay.
Okay.
Thank you.
Good. Let's receive and file that wonderful update and move on to open public comment. Now's the time for anyone in the audience who hasn't. Is there anyone left in the audience who wishes to speak to any item not on the agenda? We know who's first, not you, Janet, the other Janet.
Oh, and Jack, invite our guests. We have extra food, I'm sure, from lunch. All the folks who came down today.
No, we're inviting them to have lunch with us.
Okay, let's bring up Janet 1 from 12D, and just start calling them out after her.
Okay, after Janet Skoll Johnson, I have Janet Stromberg and Richard Gray.
Good, thank you. Okay, Janet.
Okay, well, too bad the place kind of got depopulated. I was going to congratulate Ms. Barrett on her reelection, given that oil industry put money against her. I gave half of my testimony earlier about the AB 617 process in West County, that is Richmond, San Pablo, and North Richmond. And I just wanted to give you a little bit more information. I had ended that part by saying that the community did not want polluters on the community steering committee, and that companies that are profiting from polluting our community should not be involved in the creation and implementation of Richmond's community air monitoring plan. Tracking California has provided a handbook for practice and a pattern for a community monitoring network, and we were directed to read that for guidance. Yet when I quoted from that guide to a BACMED staff member on how and why Imperial County excluded industry from their community steering committee, I was told that industry must have a seat at the table, otherwise they may challenge the findings of the study. Well, I thought that's why we have science advisors, that if the science is technically sound, I don't think the Air District will have a problem with that. Oil companies are not productive partners in emissions reductions. You know this. Much less public health. Thank you.
Thank you, Janet. Janet? Janet, too.
Yes. I just wanted to point out, I went to the last Advisory Council committee meeting, and a really interesting question was posed by staff asking the Advisory Council to consider is what should be the Air District's particulate matter goal. And I thought that was a really significant question because officially we're in attainment, you are in attainment, the region's in attainment with the federal standard, and the state does not require a planning program for PM for being out of attainment. And I think it begs the question of perhaps the Air District might want to consider developing a particulate plan once it decides what its particulate emission reduction goal is. And a suggestion I would like to make is to make that a central topic of the next Advisory Council meeting and invite speakers to present various points of view about how such a goal would be set and expand that conversation, because I thought it was really interesting question.
Thank you.
Okay. Mr. Gray. Goes the mask.
Yeah. Thanks once again. I want, you know, in response to some of the board members' comments, this is an air district that is one of the best in the country. I acknowledge that, and I think we're very lucky. And they have been doing great work. They have been there have been declining emissions in certain areas. But to Director Sparing, you know, the problem is that we have cumulative emissions, and you know that's not just GHG. GHG cumulative emissions are what are driving climate change. But it's also an issue in terms of PM. I live in an area where there's a lot of PM in the atmosphere during winters, and it accumulates in my body because it goes in, it doesn't come out. And so the last week has been extremely challenging from that point of view. The other thing I wanted to say is the oil companies, as previous speaker said, they are putting millions of dollars against candidates like Teresa Barrett to get rid of them because they want to control our country. They want to control the world. I think perhaps they already do. And they put some $30 million against a measure in Washington State for a carbon tax. They are not our friends in this in this fight against against climate change. I want to repeat what Janet Stromberg said. We need a robust PM strategy. We need a wet scrubber rule for cat crackers, and I'm really hoping that that comes up on the agenda of this agency in the coming year. Thanks.
Thank you. One more.
Mishwali again. I'm disappointed that the board member who spoke about the forests and the fires has left, but perhaps you can share this information with her. I'm also a part-time naturalist at Camp Mather. I've been doing that for 25 or 30 years. So I'm familiar with the forests in the Tuolumne River watershed. And having looked at, you know, seeing what's happened with them as climate chaos has increased, it's not just the fires that are causing damage, but it's the pine bark beetle that it has done actually more damage than the fires to the trees because of the drought. And we know that the drought is connected to climate chaos. So what's happening in the forest is that the underbrush is no longer moist. The small trees are no longer moist because they can't reach down and get water that's deep. And even the larger trees now are under stress. And so the pine bark beetle, which is a native beetle, just takes advantage. We need to go in, not the logging companies necessarily, but like a conservation corps, to go in and clean up the debris and create, it's called berms and swales, which catch any water runoff and spread it out and sink it down so that the soil can retain moisture, because otherwise we're just going to have muddy slopes and mud going into the rivers. So it is connected to the air quality, you know, these continuing fires. So I suggest some opportunity to work with Forest Service, National Forest Service, CAL FIRE to figure out how to address this problem of our decaying forests that become flammable and cause this air toxic air condition. We need to regenerate our forests, and that's one way, is to get the brush out and do the swales and berms and get them to retain and replant and retain moisture. So thank you very much.
Thank you. Any further speakers or public comment? Don't see any further speakers here. Close public comment. Board member comments. You want to start us off, Mr. Sparing?
Jack, can you bring back to us the fence line monitoring? Where are we with that? You know, if there's one thing that I'm hearing a lot of discussion, you know, from some, a lot of my constituents, is what is the status of it? Where are we? And how soon can we expect to have it in a kind of a meaningful way around? I'm more concerned on the refineries.
Absolutely. It's actually a component of 1215. There's both fence line as well as what I refer to as neighborhood monitoring that's required of this refinery. So we'll bring that back.
Thank you. Tyrone? Oh, come on. John?
All I will say is, and those of you who were in Edmonton when we were taking the trip back, the smoke, if you can believe this,
far worse.
The smoke in Edmonton was actually far worse than what we've experienced. It was almost dark at 8:30 in the morning,
yeah.
And it was, I don't know how many, what the air quality index was, but it was clearly worse than what we've experienced here in San Francisco.
Calgary, too, same
yes,
time.
Yeah.
It was spreading.
It was in Calgary and Edmonton from all the British fires in British Columbia, right? This was in early August.
The Tour de France, they had that off-the-map rating or whatever for a mountain. That was it. Go ahead.
Thank you very much. Jack, thank you. First of all, let me thank you and your staff.
And Jack, we didn't wear masks, unfortunately, right?
I want to thank you and your staff for providing N95 masks. Jack, I serve as the chair of San Mateo County OES. One of the things, and I don't know if we can talk about this in greater depth, but is looking with different OES or public health agencies to really talk about potentially a plan for the distribution of masks at a greater level. And what does that involve? If it's, is it different partners? Is the county public health? Because, you know, one of the cities had reached out to me and said, you know, what is your OES doing, your public health doing for masks? But I think if there was greater cooperation and collaboration, at least there's a starting point for discussion. And so with that, Mr. Chair, those are my comments. Thank you.
Thank you. Director Joya for follow-up.
Yeah, I just wanted to add. I know because there was a comment about whether the district had gotten masks out. I want to acknowledge the district was great. I mean, Wayne Keno, we probably over the course of a week distributed around 1,500 masks that were sent over. to our health department, to get out to the homeless encampments, to community-based organizations that serve many vulnerable populations, as well as to the general public. We had it on Nextdoor, we had it on by email, we had it on Facebook, we had it on Twitter. So, and people really appreciated that. So I just wanted to acknowledge that effort.
Director Sinks? Good. All right. We're off board member comments. Report of the executive director. Katie said you're doing hers too.
I did not know that.
She was Katie went to a CEB meeting. That's hers. That's it.
So I'll just mention real quickly on the wildfires, and Director Canepa, just following up on your comment, I think it's a great idea, by the way, on the plan, because we have had a considerable amount of conversation with the health officers, and you would think that there would be a complete agreement, and there isn't necessarily, about how to provide the best information out to the public on the use of these masks. The information you do see about their fitting and making sure, first and foremost, you stay indoors instead of, you know, and limit your outdoor activity, that kind of thing. That all comes from this conversation, right? But there's clearly more that needs to be done, and I really like the idea of a plan, so thank you for that.
Jack, let me just say this. It was actually the Bay Area Quality Management District that was leading on this issue. Mm-hmm. So just thank you, and I think we have, you know, as counties, we can learn from best practices from the district. So I'm looking forward to that conversation.
A lot of board members. We've been interacting a lot with a lot of board members and their staffs. And it's really been headed by Wayne. I want to recognize his effort during the weekend, getting out masks and everything else. He had a whole presentation for you, but given the time, I think he's going to just point out this one slide.
I just wanted to point out this one slide. This is the air quality measured. It's really busy. I understand that. But it's all the monitoring, all the monitors that we have in the district. It shows, you know, the highest levels. That one peak, the green one on, I think it was 16th, is San Pablo, the city San Pablo. We reached some very high levels, even as high as Canada here. We're talking the 300-plus levels PM. So this was a remarkable. Our staff worked so hard, Jack leading us all, Eric's group doing all the meteorology. Our air monitors went down. We had to get people out there to fix our air monitoring system, get them back up. So, and Lisa's group just doing a tremendous amount of interviews and so forth to try and get the message out on these masks. So just tremendous effort. I just want to see, there is a positive note coming up here, the weather. Tuesday is a transition day for us. Tomorrow is a transition day. There's a weather system coming in, and hopefully that weather system will clear out some of this air and will be good for Thanksgiving. There's some rain coming, and hopefully we'll be through this and just now can focus on preparation for the next.
Isn't it amazing how the skiers catch a storm right before Thanksgiving? Every year.
It is true. You've probably heard this in the press. We have experienced the worst air quality in the world, and that's absolutely true. This monitoring data bears that out. So I did also want to recognize Eric Stevenson and his staff. We've actually had monitors go down. Wasn't that in up in Sonoma County, Sebastopol, where they had to go out there and make sure it was fixed and up and running. So it's been a phenomenal, or I should say a horrific experience here at the district over the last several days, as you can tell, the last 10 days. And we are hopefully not going to experience this after about two more days with the systems that are coming in. But one thing we have learned is we're going to be stocking up. If I recall, Wayne, we were going to be stocking up on masks, and we were able to secure some more, by the way. And we'll get that message out to the board. So
stores will love you.
That's my report, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. I have a brief report before I do. I can't let that go, what John brought up. I was looking at that what you just had on the screen, and you noticed that before 11/8, November 8th, you had virtually nothing to worry about. Well, I had nothing to worry about because I left town. But the reality is that wasn't the refineries that caused that spike, and I'm not going to let go of this. When we were in Edmonton, I looked out the front door at a building maybe 100 feet further away than that. I said, can you believe how dirty that building is? And I said it three times till I walked outside and there was no building. It was the air.
worst air I've ever seen anywhere, not even close what we have now. It seemed like it was 10 times worse in the morning, though it probably isn't. The real problem exists that we're getting into November with these fires. Now we're in the spare the air mandatory. I mean, we're talking about making changes on emissions and tar sands, et cetera. You tell me what we're going to do next year in August if there are 600 more fires around BC. I mean, there's an opportunity to make an immediate change, and you're telling me that the refineries aren't doing anything. Nobody's asking them to do anything about these fires. And all we have that I've seen is SB 901 DOT. What difference does it make if California does it and no one else does it? In August, you could see the fires from Canada in the air. Enough of my report. Let me get on to the real important stuff. Congratulations to Pauline Cutter Russo in her reappointment by the Alameda County Mayor's Conference to serve another two-year term from November 2018 through November 20th. Congratulations to Secretary, soon-to-be Vice Chair, Rod Sakes on his reappointment by the City's Association of Santa Clara to serve another 2 years to be extended in one-year increments if the Air District so chooses, starting on November 2018 to November 2020. Next Board of Directors meetings will be on Wednesday, December 19th at 9:30 a.m. We are adjourned.
All righty.
You know.